have roll call, please?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Here.
Mayor Hill is absent.
And then would you please join me in a moment of reflection? And the Roy Graney Tree Guild will lead the flag salute. Welcome, Scott.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I gave him forewarning.
And that brings us to close agenda review. Is there anyone on the council that would be interested in moving anything around on the agenda?
No, thank you.
No, thank you, Mayor Pro Tem.
Okay, thank you for that. And then we go to closed session announcements. Tim, do we have anything to announce this evening?
No formal announcements. Let me just review what the council discussed in closed session. On the 24th, they discussed the Santa Maria groundwater litigation and specifically issues regarding the Napomo Mesa. On the 27th, they discussed the status of the city manager recruitment. On the 28th, they also discussed the status of the city manager recruitment. On the 31st, they did the same, and they also discussed the city attorney's performance.
Okay, thank you for that. And 5B, move that all ordinances presented for an introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
Do we need a roll call for that, Kitty? No. Okay. Thank you. And special, that brings us to special
presentation.
Aye. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Special presentations. We have four this evening. The first one is a proclamation, and I have, I think, Jesse Torrey here to accept the proclamation. Sexual assault and sexual harassment impact our community as seen by statistics indicating that 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And whereas 1 in 4 women on college campuses will experience a sexual assault while pursuing higher education. And whereas child sexual abuse prevention must be a priority to confront the reality that 44% of sexual assault survivors are under the age of 18. And whereas we must work together to educate our community about sexual violence prevention, supporting survivors, and speaking out against harmful attitudes and actions. Whereas staff and volunteers of RISE encourage every person to speak out when witnessing acts of violence, however small. And whereas with leadership, dedication, and encouragement, there is compelling evidence that we can be successful in reducing sexual violence in San Luis Obispo County through prevention, education, increased awareness, and holding perpetrators who commit acts of violence responsible for their actions. And whereas the City of Arroyo Grande strongly supports the efforts of RISE and of every citizen to engage in public and private efforts, including conversations about what sexual violence is, how to prevent it, how to help survivors connect with services, how to start by believing when a loved one discloses an experience, and how every segment of every society can work together to better address sexual violence. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Kristen Barnidge, Mayor Pro Tem for Jim Hill, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, do hereby proclaim April 2015 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month and urge every citizen to actively engage in efforts to prevent sexual violence, help survivors connect with services, start by believing when a loved one discloses an experience, and work together to better address sexual violence. And if you, this is for you. And if you'd like, say some words about your organization.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge and the City Council. I'm honored to be here tonight. And again, my name is Jessie Torrey, and I am the Associate Director of RISE. We are the only nonprofit organization that serves survivors of sexual and intimate partner violence all throughout San Luis Obispo County. We provide domestic violence services in the North County and the sexual assault services countywide. Last year, RISE helped almost 400 women, men, and children who had been affected by sexual assault or abuse. We also provided education services and self-defense classes to hundreds in our community in an effort to prevent this crime from happening in the first place. Our vision is to create a world that's free of sexual violence, and that means we have to be aware and take action. We are inviting all the county residents to participate in any of our awareness-raising activities this month, including self-defense workshops and Take Back the Night at Farmers Market in San Luis Obispo in partnership with Cal Poly Safer Program. This year, we are excited to continue to present our 13th annual Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event in San Luis Obispo, held at Mission Plaza in downtown SLO on Saturday, April 25th. The event features live music, a brief program, an awareness fair, and a one-mile walk through downtown. And it is a fun event to raise awareness for a very difficult and serious topic, and you will see lots of men wearing high-heeled shoes, and it's a sight not to be missed, I must say. Please check out our website at riseslo.org for details and registration information. But most importantly, Sexual Assault Awareness Month is about honoring victims, whether they've told their story or not. We do this by raising awareness and destroying myths that make it difficult for survivors to talk about their experiences. And lastly, I would like to thank and acknowledge the staff, volunteers, and board of directors for all of the hard work they do in an effort to end sexual assault in our community. They are an incredible group of people that are absolutely dedicated to their work, and I am honored to work with such a compassionate group of people every day. Thank you again for this proclamation, and I hope to see you on the 25th in Mission Plaza. Thank you.
And the next proclamation, Maddie Quaglino is here to accept that. The City of Arroyo Grande would like to present this honorary proclamation declaring April 2014, I guess it's probably supposed to say April 2015, as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month, and April 11, 2015 as Day of the Child. Whereas Saturday, April 1st, 2015, will commemorate the 37th annual Children's Day on the Plaza celebration in the San Luis Obispo Mission Plaza, this year's celebration marks a special partnership with Arts Obispo's Passport to the Arts, where children and families will have the opportunity to discover creativity, individuality, diversity, and the arts while exploring community resources. And whereas Month of the Child and Child Prevention Abuse Prevention Month is a time to recognize that children's opportunities are our responsibilities and to commit ourselves to ensuring that each and every child experiences a high-quality environment at home, at childcare, at school, and in the community that will promote their optimal development. And whereas every moment in a child's life is an opportunity for that child to learn, and that the quality of these experiences may determine whether a child succeeds in school and in life, and that all children need caring and loving adults in their lives, and whereas this month's activities will provide an opportunity to acknowledge youth and early care and education programs, and to raise the awareness of the community, employers, and elected officials of the need to improve the quality, availability, and accessibility of such programs. And whereas, may we remember to listen to and watch the children around us, to have patience, and to allow them the opportunity to enjoy the journey of childhood. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande hereby proclaims April 2015 as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month, and April 11th, 2015 as Day of the Child. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
Thank you, council members and pro tem mayor. Thank you very much for this opportunity for us to receive this proclamation on behalf of the Child Care Planning Council of San Luis Obispo. Tonight with me, I have a staff member, Ms. Cassie, and also families and a child with us. Come on up. We have gifts for you. It's a very busy evening for the children, and most of them are already heading off to bed, so pardon they're not here this evening, but they have artwork for you that they worked on, and so they're going to present that to you.
Lane,
there you go. There you go. Yeah. So the children made artwork to brighten up your chambers, and they hope you appreciate their dedication of fun and exploration with art. An upcoming event that our Children's Center is having is April 26th, and we're going to celebrate art with the children. We're having an ice cream social and a silent art auction where the children have made art representations of Monet, Pollock, Kandinsky, and Warhol. The proceeds from this very fun event will help us purchase items for our program. So we hope that you enjoy the gifts that we presented you, and if you'd like, you can follow us on Facebook and also visit our website at agumcc.org. You're welcome.
Okay, our third proclamation, Scott Dallin is here from the Tree Guild to accept that. The City of Arroyo Grande would like to present this honorary proclamation declaring April 24, 2015 as Arbor Day. Whereas in 1872, J. Sterling Morton proposed to the Nebraska Board of Agriculture that a special day be set aside for the planting of trees, and whereas this holiday called Arbor Day was first observed with the planting of more than a million trees in Nebraska, and whereas 2015 is the 143rd anniversary of Arbor Day and is now observed throughout the nation and the world, and whereas trees can reduce the erosion of our precious topsoil by wind and water, cutting heating and cooling costs, moderate the temperature, clean the air, produce life-giving oxygen, and provide habitat for wildlife. And whereas trees are a renewable resource giving us paper, wood for our homes, fuel for our fires, and countless other wood products, increase property values, enhance the economic vitality of business areas, beautify our community, and trees are a source of joy and spiritual renewal. And whereas the City of Arroyo Grande has been recognized as a Tree City USA by the National Arbor Day Foundation for the 33rd consecutive year and desires to continue its tree planting ways. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Kristen Barnett, Mayor Pro Tem of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby recognize and proclaim April 24th as Arbor Day in the City of Arroyo Grande and urge all citizens to celebrate Arbor Day to support efforts to care for our trees and to support our city's community forestry program. Be it further resolved that all citizens are urged to plant a tree to gladden the heart and promote the well-being of this and future generations. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Barnett and Council, for recognizing Arbor Day and the Tree Guild. So thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Barnett and Council, for recognizing the importance of Arbor Day and the Tree Guild. Trees play an important role in our community, and we feel very fortunate to be able to work with the Public Works Director, Jeff English, and the city on this task. The opportunity to partner with the city on tree planting projects helps us achieve our mission, and it's a partnership that we greatly appreciate. The Tree Guild is a nonprofit 501c3 organization that was formed in 2005. Since that time, we've planted 321 trees. Our mission is to preserve and enhance the urban forest of Arroyo Grande. As the proclamation states, Trees not only look nice and create shade, they also save energy, improve our air quality, reduce stormwater runoff, and increase property values. Our next project will be to plant trees at the dog park and at the railroad kiosk here in the village. If you're interested in learning more about the Tree Guild or becoming a member, you can go to our website at treeguild.org. Thank you. And I believe Pete would like to say a couple words.
Mayor Barnage, Mayor Pro Tem Barnage. Pete, I want the council just to acknowledge and Ron Simpson, our streets and landscape supervisor, and Pete McClure, who is a maintenance worker and the city arborist, and he had a gift to hand out tonight. We are proud of our tree protection program and our partnership with the Tree Guild, and wanted to thank you for that this evening. And Pete, I don't know if you have any words or...
Sure. I would just like to present the Arbor Day flag, plaque, and hat to the Mayor Pro Tem, Kristen.
Thank you, Pete.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Jeff. Okay. Now we are to item 6D under special presentations, and I think we had. So what we're going to do is, because this is under presentations, we're going to have the three groups present for 10 minutes each, and then we will have any public that would like to speak, we will do that under community comments, which is directly after that, if you'd like to speak on this. And there are speaker slips in the back of the room. I have some here, but there are more back there. If you are planning to speak, if you could fill one out, that would be wonderful. And so we will start the presentation with Phillips 66, if they'd like to come forward and start, please.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem Barnage and members of the City Council. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present our project today. I'm Jim Anderson, and I'm the maintenance superintendent and the project manager for the rail project at the Phillips 66 Santa Maria Refinery. Oh, thank you. Okay. Got to go through this kind of fast. So just a little bit of background about our facility. We're a key contributor to California's supply of clean gasoline, and we provide the initial step in the refining process to produce gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. We do not produce any finished products at our refinery. Rather, we produce a semi-refined product that's shipped to our sister refinery in Rodeo, California, where it's finished processed into gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. And our production rate is 48,000 barrels per day. We employ roughly about 200 people between company employees and contractors. Our operators and maintenance personnel are members of the United Steelworkers International Union. Virtually all those jobs are union scale, high-paying, head-of-household jobs with typical salary you see there, plus excellent fringe benefits and medical benefits. Our payroll exceeds $43 million, more than $2 million a year we pay in state and local taxes. And we spend roughly about $31 million annually purchasing from vendors. Not all of it in the local area. Much of it is in the local area, but as you can understand, some of the vendors that we use for our pumps and specialized equipment are not manufactured in this immediate area. What our project proposal is that we request approval to extend our existing rail spur track on our property, entirely on our property, and construct a crude by rail unloading facility, and that'll give us the capability to unload crude oil that would be received by train. This is just an aerial photograph showing the refinery property in yellow here. This line right here is the existing Amtrak or Union Pacific mainline rail that both freight and passenger services transported on. And our existing spur comes off and ends right about there. And then the blue line shows the extension of where the we would propose to put the extension of the existing spur. Project is necessary because of the dramatic decline in the production of California crudes due to sources and permitting and other environmental events. We need external sources of crude to ensure the continued viability of the refinery. Right now, all of the crude comes to the refinery by pipeline. We don't have a truck terminal, we don't have a rail terminal, and of course we don't have a marine terminal. So we're one of the few refineries that maybe even the only refinery that receives 100% of its crude by pipeline. These pipelines only extend into San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. In other words, there's no pipelines that extend to the Midwest or to the South or the Gulf Coast or anything from that bring crude oil into California. So our pipelines extend, as I mentioned, into San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties only. And so this will be a way for us to source crude from outside the immediate area. What our proposal is to do is to install tracking facilities to receive up to 5 80-car unit trains. Now let me put that a little bit in perspective. We have unit trains that come through the county presently about 2 to 3 times a week that run from the San Arto oil field carrying crude oil very similar to the crude oil that we would bring in, very similar to the crude oil we refine right now. It's a heavy sour crude. Sour means it's high in sulfur. Heavy just means it's thick and viscous and not very volatile. So the existing train is actually a 78-car train, so it's about 100 or so feet shorter, but very similar in size for comparison. And this will only change the way that crude oil is presently received at the refinery. It won't change, the amount of production or the throughput. What we're not proposing, we don't need any increase in storage capacity because we're not going to have any increase in production or throughput. There will be no changes to the refining process since the crude oil that we propose to bring in is the type of crude oil the refinery was designed to process. And originally to process the heavy sour OCS or outer continental shelf crude that's produced here in the local area that's in decline right now. So we're looking for that kind of crude to bring in by train from elsewhere, a heavy sour crude. We won't be bringing in any Bakken crude. You may have heard about Bakken crude being a light, sweet crude, a little bit more volatile. Certainly other refineries can refine that and transport it safely. We cannot. Our refinery is just not designed to handle a light, sweet crude. Sweet meaning low in sulfur, light meaning very thin with, a lot of light material in it. There won't be any increase in our coke piles. One of our byproducts that we make after we refine and get all the gas and liquids out of the crude oil, we're left with solid carbon or petroleum coke. And since we're not increasing our throughput, and since the oil that we will bring in is very, very similar to what we have, it has a small amount less coke in it than what we have now, our coke piles won't increase. In addition to that, we have a permit condition in our air permit right now that's issued by the San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District that limits the size of the coke piles anyway. So there won't be any increase in the coke piles and, of course, no increase in volatility because our refinery is not fit to handle light crudes. Some background, we've operated safely for over 60 years. The rail cars in our fleet meet or exceed federal safety requirements. We're working at the state level right now on new legislation that will fund additional hazmat training and equipment. This would be a fee that would be on each barrel of oil that is actually unloaded or loaded in the state, not transported, because the railroads are federally regulated, and the state really can't do a fee on transportation. So our proposal, the one we're supporting, is that the fee would be on a barrel of oil either loaded or unloaded in California, and that would fund this additional hazmat training and equipment. And then, of course, as you'll hear soon, Union Pacific operates with high-tech safety measures and has a very impressive safety record. Again, crude oil trains have been traveling through San Luis Obispo County for more than a decade in a similar size and hauling very similar material. So where we are in the approval process is we circulated the draft EIR last fall. The comments are being processed. We're awaiting the final EIR. Hopefully that'll be out in the next few weeks. And then The process is that we would be going to a hearing before the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission for their review and hopefully approval. One thing that I'd like to leave you with is, before passing judgment on the project, to wait for the final EIR to come out, because there have been changes to the project made through the EIR process to improve the project, to make it better, to make it less environmental, have less environmental impacts. And so it's important to read and understand the final EIR, which will describe the project as it will be considered with all the conditions present at that time. And with that, I have a couple minutes. If anybody has any questions, I'd certainly be glad to answer.
Do you think we should take questions at the end of all three presentations, or should we do them at each?
I'd rather do them while they're still here, because they'd be fresh.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, go ahead, Tim.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. You didn't really talk about where the crude is coming from. You just said it wasn't Balkan crude. Can you elaborate a little more on...
The crude will be coming from North America, most likely Canadian crude, or somewhere in the upper Midwest or Utah. Really, any place in the United States that produces a heavy sour crude and is served by rail.
Okay, so explain to me, I've always heard that, at least with the Balkan crude, that if you transport it by rail, it gets oxygenated and becomes more volatile. Can you describe if you're having it travel that long a distance, what's the volatility like as it travels and gets oxygenated down the road?
Well, really, it's the volatility, and that's, I'll refer to that as light ends. Light ends are the smaller hydrocarbon molecules, such, you know, the lightest one, of course, is methane that you burn in your, you know, furnaces and your clothes dryers and your heaters. And then from that point, that's a gas. And I know you know what a butane lighter is. That's a little bit heavier gas. And then you'll get to a light liquid like a gasoline range material. And those are the lighter hydrocarbons. The Bakken crude contains more lighter hydrocarbons. It's a more valuable crude. You can make more gasoline from it easier because it has those lighter ends in it. Our refinery is designed to refine oil that has the heavier ends in it. That doesn't have it. It still has some of the gas and lighter ends in it, but not nearly as much. I'm going to say probably a third or less as much. Whereas a Bakken crude's vapor pressure, its volatility would be maybe 13 to 14 PSI. The crude that we're going to be refining would be like a 4, something like that. That would be its sort of one measure of its, quote, volatility.
Okay. The other thing I'm trying to understand is, my understanding, anything on rail is federally regulated. So where does San Luis County fit in terms of the regulatory scheme, when it seems to me like this is something that we may have an opinion on, but I'm not clear on what the jurisdictional issue is here?
Right. Since we're a private company and we're going to be building, or we propose to build, the facility on our property and be owned by us, meaning Phillips 66, then we would need to go and get a coastal development permit, a land use permit from San Luis Obispo County to build that facility. The county really has no regulatory authority over what goes up and down the mainline rail. So whether our project is built or not, oil will go up and down the main, or anything that the railroad, and as you'll hear, hauls, can go up and down the mainline rail. So the really issue is can we build this offloading facility or not? There's no regulatory approval on the part of the county for what goes up and down the mainline.
That's in San Luis County, not Santa Barbara County.
We're in San Luis Obispo County, yes.
Yeah. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Barbara?
Yes, thank you. Could you explain briefly what positive train control is? Isn't there ability to...
You know, Lisa is here.
Is that for Lisa?
Yes, okay, she will be able to address that very well.
Okay, and then I have two other questions. Then once the when and if these cars come and they get offloaded, then will the cars that are empty, like they're not going to be refilled and then shipped back?
That's correct.
They will be empty when they leave us.
That's correct. We will not ship out any products on the cars. They will be empty when they leave the refinery.
So then with that being said, then the finished product will then be transported like it is now via pipeline to the Santa Maria facility?
To the Rodeo facility.
Okay.
Yeah, from the amount of products and the way the products are shipped will remain the same in the future. They'll go by pipeline to our facility in Rodeo in the Bay Area.
Okay, so there's no at this point, no nexus related to transportation by truck?
No, not well. No, we don't have a truck terminal. We cannot unload crude oil, nor can we load products onto trucks at the refinery.
Okay.
That's correct.
Very good. Thank you. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. Jen?
Yeah, I have a couple questions. The crude that you're transporting, the heavy crude, I know when you send it up to Rodeo, you have to mix it with something else in order to get it to flow. Do you have to mix it with something else to get it to be transportable in the...
Yes.
And what does that do to its volatility when you mix it with something else?
What the oil, as it's produced by the producers wherever, is such a heavy, thick oil that temperatures below about 70 or 60 degrees, it's solid. So you do need to mix it with another lighter fluid to get it to flow. So what they'll do is they'll put what's called a diluent in it. Now, you can put a lot of diluent in it and spend a lot of money and make it very volatile. In our case, they'll put a little bit of diluent in it to save a lot of money and make it as little volatility as they can just to get it to flow onto the car and to flow off the car when we receive it. So with the diluent in it, the properties of volatility will be very, very, and you'll see this in the final EIR, will be very, very similar to the crude oil that we refine today and very similar to the crude oil that goes up and down the tracks on the main line 2 to 3 times a week.
So that's a procedure that would be controlled by market forces as opposed to by – there's no regulation as to how you would mix it. It's purely that you would want as little work as possible.
I would say that's right. Yeah, you'd want to. It'd be – you know, would you rather have a car that gets 20 miles a gallon or 5 miles a gallon? So, you want to use as little as possible and still get it to flow.
Okay. My second question has to do with the – how difficult would it be for you to reset up the refinery to in fact, refine lighter crudes? And both from a regulatory standpoint, I realize the county probably, other than the air pollution control district, has no input, but even from the state or the federal level.
No, actually with us, the county and the Air Pollution Control District would be hugely involved with that because it would take major undertakings to install literally tens of millions of dollars of new equipment to be able to handle a light crude such as a Bakken. It's just, we don't, as I mentioned about these light ends, this lighter material, we don't have the processing equipment to handle that volume of the lighter material.
My last question just has to do with and I realize this is all probably very much up in the air, but what is your timing before you think that you actually get to the San Luis Obispo Planning Commission?
Well, we hope to be before the Planning Commission sometime this summer. That's our hope.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. How many oil trains right now pass through our county?
Roughly 2 to 3 per week. Okay. Well, those are the unit trains. What the other trains that may be – those are the ones from San Ardo to Los Angeles, and at least I won't be able to tell you that because it's really confident, but I observe it going by my refinery, and sometimes they park right out there too, so, and that's a source of frustration for me too.
Okay, and then it's with the expansion you're asking for, it would be 260 trains per year, is that correct?
Let's see, 5 times 52, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I don't know if you talked about it, or maybe I can ask the Union Pacific rep when they come up. The cars that would be bringing the oil to the refinery, are those the .11 cars or the newer 1232 cars?
Ours and in the Phillips 66 fleet, all the ones that would come to the refinery would be the CPC 1232.
Okay, those are my only questions right now. Thank you very much for that presentation.
Thank you.
And we will hear from the Mesa Refinery Watch Group next, please.
Let's see, how do we get this up? Hopefully this works. Button. Well, first of all, thank you, folks, for the opportunity to address the council and Mayor Pro Tem Christine. I appreciate this, and I have to thank Kitty for taking all my emails and uploading the data, and Robert McFall for making sure I follow the rules here. Okay, we are the Mesa Refinery Watch Group, and we are a local organization down here in the Pomo. We have a simple thing there. We say if we don't allow Phillips to build the rail terminal, the trains won't come. It's as simple as that. We oppose the Phillips 66 project. We are your neighbors who are concerned about our community. We are convinced that this project must be stopped because of its negative impacts on the health, safety, and financial well-being of San Luis Obispo County. We are not about shutting down the refinery. In fact, the spokesman for the refinery, Dennis Nutt, said when asked, and there has been no discussion about the refinery closing should the project not be approved. Phillips frames this as a jobs issue, but that's misleading. No jobs will be lost should the project be denied. It will be business as usual with no financial impact to the community, and Phillips will continue to source its crude by pipeline. They talk about the diminishing feedstock or oil. We say, really? Their production has been steadily increased since 2009, and 2013 was their highest production. In the Central Coast, production has been up 28.5%. And they just had a 10% increase in capacity, so diminishing feedstock, we question that. What is the Phillips 66 corporate strategy? That's right in their annual report. They say changing the way of doing business with from a passive pipeline to an intrusive oil-by-rail operation to access lower-cost advantage crude and deliver it via crude by rail. Nothing about diminishing feedstock. The report continues with the shale revolution has the potential to give Phillips a competitive advantage in the global marketplace. That's the operant word, global. Not domestic, global. That means the oil will be production will come through the United States, not to the United States. In other words, they want to avail themselves of advantage crude, which means a lower crude price, no matter what the cost to the community. A half a billion barrels of crude per year forever. It's not 1 year. It's forever if this project gets approved. Five unit trains of 80 crude oil tanker cars, each 1.5 miles long. Not a mile. The math is below on the slide. Cars are 90 feet long. Do the math. 90 feet by 80 cars. A couple of three diesel engines, a buffer car, and you're approaching 1.45 miles. The Mesa Refinery Watch got Bakken off the table. We were one of the first out there, you know, saying this is not something that shouldn't be coming down the rails. This was in the first EIR. Now the issue is Canadian tar sands. I feel like it's whack-a-mole here. Equally explosive as Bakken, but also the dirtiest, most toxic and polluting crude oil there is. Just do the homework on it. It's not a pleasant product. Tar sands will be coming down the tracks. It's not the same crude that Phillips 66 now refines or the type of crude that presently comes down from San Otto. It is a highly volatile kind of crude oil. It is tar sands. One of my friends said, if you already have rattlesnakes in your front yard, why would you invite five more into your house? Meaning, yes, there are already trains coming down the rails, but why add five more a week or have a half a billion barrels of oil coming down year after year after year. Tar sands is just as dangerous. It is a highly viscous substance extracted from Alberta oil sands. It's like asphalt. To make it flow, a dilutant needs to be added to the tar sands. It makes it volatile due to lowering its flash point. Who said so? Railway Age said so. They're an industry trade magazine. They said the widespread belief that bitumen tar sands from Alberta's northern oil sands is far safer to transport by rail than Bakken crude is, for all intents and purposes, dead wrong. They talk about the new rail car, the CPC 1232. Recent derailments have proven that the CPC 1232 tanker car purchased by Phillips are no safer than the older DOT 111s. Read, within the last 2 months, Lynchburg, Carbonville, Virginia, and Gogama, Ontario, four derailments, all with the CPC 32s. Yet the CEO of the American Petroleum Institute, Jack Girard, wrote that an interim rule adopting the CPC 1232 built in good faith should remain in service for their useful life without major retrofits. So they're talking out of two sides of their mouth here. They made a bad business decision purchasing these 1232s, and we would have to live with it. And then Cynthia Quarterman, of the former director of the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, said in recent incidents confirmed that the CPC 1232 just doesn't cut it. There's a picture of a derailment. We are playing oil roulette. The NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, wants all existing DOT 111s and CPC 1232 tank cars either off the rails or fully upgraded with thermal protection within 5 years. They're calling that tanks and blankets because they would want to mitigate the kind of explosive content that it carries. The DOT predicts 10 high-consequence derailments every year for the next two decades, with lives lost and billions in expenditures. More trains mean more risk to air quality. I want you to gander at that picture. That's what it looks like. The effects of diesel exhaust exposure includes lung function changes, respiratory changes, and a number of profound inflammatory changes in the airways. The EPA chimes in and says inhalation exposure is likely to pose lung cancer in humans. This is what's coming down the main line. The Arroyo Grande is in the blast zone. Folks, this was in the Wall Street Journal today. This was from FEMA, talking about blast zones that are in and around where the trains come down. The local meeting down in Guadalupe, the chief of public safety said the shock wave would be felt 1.5 miles away. That's about the distance to where we are right now. Rail cars could be launched like projectiles into the air. A debris field and shrapnel will spread about 3,000 feet. An evacuation zone of over a mile, and a black cab wafting over the community. That is what it would look like. If you look down below, you'll see the train. We are not prepared. First responders are underfunded, undertrained, and under-equipped, and underprepared for an oil train disaster. Yet, Union Pacific Railroad has filed a lawsuit that challenges the new California state law requiring them to come up with oil prevention and response plans. They're going to mitigate this through litigation. The nearest certified hazmat response is in Santa Barbara. When asked how these fires would be extinguished by any fire chiefs, they say the standard answer is to let it burn itself out. Consider this. What would the environmental impacts be to communities along the main line right here? What would the financial impacts be should there be an explosion? How many jobs would be lost? And what would the financial impact be for lost business and agribusiness and agritourism? What would be the impact on attracting new business to the community? That picture was about 29 years ago in Grover Beach. It does happen. Consider the derailments as of 2013. These are the derailments in 2014. Derailments through March of 2015. And this is only not including this week where there were 3 or 4 or 5 new derailments. That's not what you want in your front yard. This project isn't about the greater good. It's about the singular benefit to one multinational oil corporation at the cost of the safety of the entire population living along the rail line. Let's not add Arroyo Grande to that roll call. These are the communities that have stepped up and said no. They have written to the county and said, no, we don't want these trains going through. These are school boards, these are communities, these are towns. Every day there's another one. Just recently Monterey just added their name to that list. Why? Because they don't want that havoc coming down the trains. We have 29 fact-based reasons, and I'll make these handout. 29. I could probably go make this 129 if I wanted to. If we don't allow Phillips to build it, the trains won't come. It's as simple as that. To learn more facts, visit the Mesa Refinery Watch at mesarefinerywatch.com. Did that in less than 10 minutes. Any questions?
I understand your concern. You're very articulate, but I want to pose a question to you and see what your response is, and that is, let's assume it goes the way that you want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
What's to keep the idea that the crude will just pass through the county and go to a county farther down south? We still would run the risk.
There's two issues here. You have an oil by rail and what we call an intrusive rail refinery, a rail terminal. It's two things. Oil by rail, nothing we can do to stop the trains coming down the tracks. We can stop those 5 trains every week if the terminal is not built. Now, the other rails come in.
Excuse me just a minute. That was the point of my question. I don't know how you stop the extra cars if they go and build it in a county that's more friendly.
Well, right now, from Union Pacific Rail Lines, they have tracks that go down through the Inland Empire, coming through Colton. And from there, they can head south into Torrance. they mostly will go into that refinery that recently blew up in that particular area, which is, I understand, now for sale by Exxon. But that's what would be, it would not be coming, from my impression of it, it would not be coming down the coastal corridor. It would be going more through the inland, from Roosevelt down into Colton, from Colton down into Torrance.
So it would just transfer the risk to a different county?
Well, those are the counties right now that are stamping up and say, we didn't even want this tar sands coming down. Now there's preemption, and that may be litigated in the court, whether they are litigating that or not. I'm not an attorney. I can't say. So I've read documentation that said it has imminent hazard. Does imminent hazard preempt preemption? I'm not an attorney. I don't know. But that's going to be litigated.
Okay, thank you. Those are my questions.
Okay, Barbara, do you have any questions?
Not at this time.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah, actually, when you had earlier there the fact that there would be no difference because we're going to have to add the dilutant to the tar sands, that there would be no difference between that and Vulcan, and I was wondering if you could put that back up so I could get the source for that, because it seems to be an odd.
Railway Age. They had the magazine. Let's see if we can get it there. And they had subsequent articles, too, in Railway Age that I didn't put up. I went there?
There you go.
Railway Age, Industry Magazine, February 23rd, 2015.
Okay, Railway Age. All right, thank you.
And then I don't think I have any questions for you, but I'm wondering if we wanted to bring Ricky Heath to answer any questions about, because he's not going to do a presentation about, I have a question of Ricky Heath, the battalion chief. Is he still? There you are, Ricky. But thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. I come from New York. I speak quickly. So.
That's okay. I don't, and I do. Hi, Ricky.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor.
The question I have is, they mentioned a couple times that there's no hazmat team here in SLO County. It's just in Santa Barbara County. Is that true?
That's incorrect. San Luis Obispo County has a regional hazmat team that is made up of all the different fire agencies, environmental health, and actually that team is just now getting ready to become typed out so that they could travel into other counties.
Okay, so if there was an emergency situation here in, say, the five cities in Grover Beach, where would that hazmat, would they be coming from different agencies, like one from Grover Beach Fire, or I'm sorry, one from Five Cities Fire Authority, maybe one from Santa Maria, one from San Luis? Sorry, that's my timer to make sure everyone stays on task.
Yes, basically what would happen is, if we had a train derailment, the hazmat team would be automatically dispatched, and it would be through mutual aid, which would bring all the different fire agencies together to that scene, and the hazmat unit will come out of North County.
Okay, so that's what. So obviously everyone's going to roll down there, but they're specifically trained in hazmat. They would not be coming from Santa Barbara. They'd be closer here in San Luis Obispo County.
Yes, and they are required to meet state-mandated training for hazardous materials response.
Okay, the same as the Santa Barbara County hazmat team.
Yes, ma'am. Just,
okay. I think those are – does anyone else have any questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of discussion about specialized training given the rail card issue. Is that something that would have to be done for you guys to be up to speed on a rail card disaster versus what you would normally deal with the hazmat situation?
We do rail car training. The last one was maybe a little bit more than a year ago in San Luis Obispo City. And, in fact, we're getting ready to bring that same type of training here to Grover Beach.
And I'm not sure you answer, but I know that Pismo Beach, the Cal Fire group there, put together a letter of, you know, with their concerns. I was trying to get a copy of that today, and I was saying we'll do that. Are you familiar with that letter, and do you know what their concerns with the?
No, sir, I haven't seen that letter. Okay. I do know that Cal Fire in Napomo Mesa, they have been working very closely with Conoco. Well, it's Phillips now. And, you know, doing inspections and communicating with them. So I think part of that information could be from that.
Could be from the Pomo.
Communication.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ricky. I appreciate the answers to the questions. Okay. And then moving right along, we have a representative from Union Pacific. Thank you.
Hi, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm going to move through these slides really quickly because when we're talking about rail safety, technology, and everything that our railroad does to invest in our infrastructure to ensure that we have a safe and efficient system, it's really compacted here, so I will do my best. But I'm Lisa Stark. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Union Pacific Railroad. Our company has been around for more than 150 years. This is actually 152nd year. When people think of rail, they think of very old technology. I would actually tell you that the railroad is very, very technologically advanced, and I'll talk about that a little more later in my presentation. You know us here running through through San Luis Obispo County, running through the state of California. We also operate in 22 other states, predominantly west of the Mississippi River. We do interchange rail traffic with Mexico and Canada, as well as our rail partners on the East Coast. I will skip past these. So when you think about when you see our trains go by, what kind of products do we haul? Well, when you think about it, we actually haul the types of products that each of us use as a consumer every day in our lives. That includes chemicals that public agencies use to make them a safe and clean drinking water supply. It's automobiles, it's bike components, it's food, it's wine. Some people think that's very important. And, of course, it's chemicals, and it is crude. Crude does not make up a large part of our business, but it does make up, you know, about 1%, including here in the state of California, and it has been cited before. We do haul crude in the state, and we have done that for decades and decades. And one thing I want you to keep in mind when you're thinking about the types of the commodities that we carry is that we're actually required as a railroad by the federal government to haul any type of commodity that is given to us by our customers as long as it's packaged according to U.S. Department of Transportation regulation. So we can't tell a customer, no, we won't haul your product because it's a hazardous material or it's an inhalation hazard. We actually are required by law to accept that for transport. I already talked about our business mix. So really, why we would haul crude oil, why we haul a lot of other types of commodities, again, it is that federal obligation we have, the federal governments have required the railroads to do, because we are a very safe mode of transportation. As far as an industry goes, the rail industry is one of the safest around, in fact, even safer than a grocery store operation. We invest a lot of money and training into our infrastructure as well as our employees to ensure we run a very safe operation. We are investing, it was about $4 billion in 2014. We're looking at about $4.3 billion of investment back into our system in 2015. That's going to go for capital projects, rail and tie replacement projects, bridge replacement projects, new technologies, and a variety of other things. And keeping in mind that that's all private capital. It is not a taxpayer-funded entity like your local streets and roads are. When you think about old school, the railroad's been around for a long time. You might think that we have had, we still make track like we did over 150 years ago. But if you want to think now about how the track has changed over time and the strength of the track, you know, it's been pretty significant. And if you think about how Caltrans constructs a highway where you have to have a bed underneath and you have to compact it and you have to do a variety of things to get your 18 inches of a good roadbed that you can have for the traveling public, it's much the same as it is with the railroad as well. We have a very robust track inspection program. Every one of our lines in California is inspected at least twice per week. We also inspect if we have significant events such as an earthquake, storm-related types of events, drought, a variety of things that could potentially impact the rail line. And we will halt actually all traffic on our rail line, for example, after an earthquake, so that we can inspect within 150-mile radius of the epicenter of an earthquake to make sure that all of our communication systems are working, all of our signals are working, and that we can run a safe railroad. The other thing, besides what we have our regular dedicated crews, we have 47 of those that are full-time on the ground inspecting those tracks on a regular basis. We also have very specialized equipment that we run over the rails. What you see right here is one of our track geometry cars. And what this does is it's lined with computers on the inside, and it's using ultrasound and lasers to actually read different things within the railroad track that would include your track geometry, curvature of your track, anything that would give us an indication that we need to go back and look at that more closely. So we do run these regularly on our tracks in California. Oops. And then I don't know what is going on with... the transfer over there. I apologize, you can't see it. But so how are we, else are we using technology to enhance safety? So one thing we've done is, as I mentioned, we do use the lasers and the ultrasound to detect rail imperfections in the rail line. We can actually forecast any potential failures in the rail line by using acoustic vibrations as the wheels travel over the railroad track. We also have trackside sensors that are located all along the railroad that take real-time readings of every rail car and locomotive that passes one of those trackside sensors. And it, by GPS satellite, it transmits all that information to our headquarters and dispatch in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's being watched continuously. That's about 20 million different rail car readings per day that we're analyzing. We also do very rigorous safety training programs with our employees. They are trained to recognize any potential signs of danger, any issues, anything that would require us to stop, you know, have to get off of a train, inspect it before we can go further. We also have, this is a rail detector system. This is a technology. We have these trucks in California. We test our main lines at least every 3 to 6 months, sometimes more is required. And what this technology does is it puts ultrasound into the rail line, and it can detect the tiniest of imperfections that might tell us we need to replace a rail. So what you see on the bottom left-hand corner of this picture is a cross-tie section with a dark shaded gray color on there. This piece of equipment went over that section of rail and determined we needed to go back and take a look at that. So when that section of rail was actually cut out of the railroad track, we determined that this was actually caused by a tiny, tiny piece of sand that was left in the rail during the manufacturing process. That wouldn't be something that would be known when we were delivered the rail, but over time, those are the types of things you can see, but we also have the specialized detection equipment to identify those before they create a problem. We have a very robust bridge inspection program. We obviously comply with all federal regulations as required, and we actually go above and beyond federal regulations on our inspection processes. We not only inspect every bridge at least 1 to 3 times a year with our own dedicated crews, but we also hire outside bridge structural consultants who come in and do another analysis on our structures as well. We obviously, our signal inspection program is very important not only for the traveling public where they cross over railroad tracks, but also for our communication systems on our trains so that all of our signals are working that are giving our train crews direction. And then a question came up about positive train control. So positive train control is it's a new system that's being deployed. It's a federal mandate on all the Class 1 railroads and the and passenger agencies that share tracks. What the system is essentially designed to do is to prevent a train-on-train collision. And this mandate was put on the railroads after the unfortunate incident down in Chatsworth where a Metrolink driver, or operator, I should say, was texting on his phone. He missed a signal, and he smacked head-on into a Union Pacific train, resulting in quite a few fatalities. Very unfortunate. So what the system does is it's a computerized system, and it gives the crews on the train very specific instructions about their speed, their stopping distances, potential hazards that may be on the tracks. And what the system is designed to do is that in the case that a crew misses anything that the computer is directing it to do, it will go into automatic shutoff. The system is actually being tested for live service down in the LA Basin right now. We're testing it for interoperability with all of the passenger agencies that we share tracks with. We're making sure everybody's communication systems work. Our timeline for full implementation of that is likely by the end of 2015. And then we'll be doing the same testing in Northern California and making sure we have interoperability, which will include this part of the state as well. And California is actually going to be the very first state in the United States that will have positive train control implemented and running live. And I'm running out of time, but I did want to point out that we do have a hazardous materials management program that's part of our public safety department. We have hazardous materials managers who work in various locations throughout the state, and they also work with local agencies specifically on training and emergency response. And Union Pacific actually provides training at free of charge to local emergency response departments, not only locally with classroom training and with our hands-on equipment. We also invite them to a specialized training on tank car response with hazmat back in Pueblo, Colorado. And we actually had a couple folks from Cal Fire that did that fairly recently. We also have some additional training coming up that I'll be talking to some folks about later. So preparedness, obviously, we're working with the communities. If a community wants to know exactly what's passing through their community, we have what's called a community right to know. A fire chief or somebody who's been vetted by the railroad can have access to that information. That's not public documentation for a variety of reasons, Homeland Security, TSA, other things that we're required to operate under. But we do have, you know, we do work, obviously, performing drills and exercises. And again, we're trying to work very closely with local agencies on training needs. And one new thing I just want to point out, we have this new tool. I have 18 seconds. It's called Ask Rail. And this is a new emergency response training tool that we're actually rolling out right now. And what it does is it gives local emergency response agencies an app that they can put on their smartphone. So in the case that there's any type of incident or they're needing to know what's in a particular rail car, they can actually look it up and they can get all that data. So, beep.
Finished just perfectly, right on time. Okay, thank you for that, Lisa. Does anyone have any questions of Lisa? Okay, go ahead, Tim.
Thank you. Is transporting fuels of any kind a large part of your revenue?
Well, as far as we're talking about crude, it's...
I know it's proprietary information, but I'm just trying to find out, just generally speaking, mm-hmm. of fuels in general. I don't want to be...
I don't have a fuels... per se number, I'm not an expert to know exactly what all would be encompassed in that, but if you're just talking about crude, it's about 1% of our business overall.
Thank you.
Barbara, question?
I just have one question related to the positive train control. As you can tell, it's intriguing to me. When you say Northern California or this area, if you're saying Southern California by the end of the year, then do you have a projected time related to the northern part of our state related to this?
We don't have a specific time because we haven't actually started the testing yet. And again, it's not just Union Pacific. It's Burlington Northern Santa Fe and it's Amtrak and some other passenger agencies. And so we really have to make sure the system works before we bring it on in live service. Sure. But I can tell you we will start testing that as soon as we're done in Southern California, which we anticipate to be, you know, by third or fourth quarter of 2015. So it's going to come, fairly quickly after that. In railroad terms, fairly quickly, probably six months to a year to 18 months.
All right. Thank you for that.
Okay, Jan, questions?
Yeah, but a few questions on derailment in general. There seems to be in the previous presentation, we had the number of derailments that have increased over the last 3 or 4 years. I'm just wondering if you comment on the accuracy of that stat.
Yeah, I haven't done an evaluation of that. I can tell you that nothing's changed in the industry over the last several years, and 99.997% of all hazardous materials are shipped without incident. That takes into account any recent derailments, and keeping in mind what a derailment report can be. It can be, you know, obviously a catastrophic type of derailment. It can also be just one wheel that comes off a track. That is categorized as a derailment as well, where you don't have any type of impact. So it's a broad range of interpretation on what that actually means.
Okay. And do you have an idea how many derailments, I guess using that definition, have taken place in California in the last...
I don't. I mean, there are multiple railroads besides Union Pacific that have to report that information to the Federal Railroad Administration and the California Public Utilities Commission. So I don't have specific data on the conglomeration of all of those in the state.
It did look like you were going to give us a stat. Is that going to be for your company? Do you know the derailments for your company?
I was going to give you a stat that we have reduced derailments by 38%. I mean, just by doing a lot of investment on our infrastructure, and we've reduced our derailments anyways by that 38% over the last 10 years.
So compared to 10 years ago, you're down 38%, perhaps.
Yes.
Compared to 5 years ago, it might be up, if that are the stats correct. The other question I had is, how fast would one of these trains, this mile-and-a-half train, be going? Mm-hmm. And when it comes through, let's say, the Five Cities area?
Sure. So keep in mind, if it was today, currently, our track speed through a lot of this area is up to 40 miles per hour. On the Cuesta grade, it's a lot lower than that. It's 20 to 25 miles per hour. But one thing that will probably dictate what ends up happening with the transport of crude is a federal decision-making process that's underway currently that's not only looking at the shipment of Bakken and putting speed limit restrictions on that, but potentially including all crude that's transported by rail. Excuse me. As part of that requirement, we're in a wait and hold pattern to see what our federal regulators actually come out with that. But that is certainly a discussion being had at the federal level.
Okay. And then, do you have to? We were told that there were three oil trains that come through the county. Are there any other oil trains that come through the county other than the San Ardo ones that you're aware of?
The ones that I think were being discussed are what we call crude unit trains. So it's a train of all different types of commodities. But we haul a variety of products, including just individual tank cars of a variety of products, including crude. Specifically through this area, I don't know right now. But, I mean, we do have what we call manifest trains, and that's a train that can be made up of any different type of commodity. But we could find out on our commodity flow report that we could provide to the fire department.
And somewhat related to that, how many trains do you think that are a mile and a half or longer come through the county on a weekly basis, whether they're oil or anything?
You know, I don't have the data on the length of train. It's, you know, we run our trains in accordance with safety practices and protocols. We know how long a train can be for curvature reasons, for incline and decline. So there isn't like an average length of train necessarily. And some of that also depends on, you know, customer demand and what's driving the economy as well.
I guess what I was trying to get at, and maybe still can't answer my question, was, you know, if we add five, I guess actually mm-hmm. 10 trains, because they've got to go in and out, if we add, is that, you know, an increase of 10% or an increase of 20% of large trains, which, and I assume there's only large trains left anymore.
Well, it tends to be more efficient to move longer trains. But again, a lot of that is just dictated by the economy. If we have customers that, you know, are we're servicing more locally here and they have more product they want to ship, the train would probably get longer versus adding another train. I mean, system-wide, I could tell you in California, our train length tend to be, you know, a mile to a mile and a half. But I don't have specific data on the lengths of trains through this area.
I was really more interested in the number, but I don't think you have that either. All right, thank you.
I do not, sorry. Okay. I can get it for you, though.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. Any other follow-up questions? No? Okay. Thank you, Lisa, okay. for that. Okay, now we are at item number 7, which is community comments and suggestions. And this is the public comment period for an invitation for all members of the community to present any issues, thoughts, or suggestions on matters not scheduled on this agenda. If you could please address the council as a whole and keep your comments to 3 minutes. I do have some speaker slips that are here. We can start with those. Gina Whitaker, go ahead and come forward, please. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Gina Whitaker. I've been a resident of Arroyo Grande for 33 years, and thank you very much for having this important discussion here tonight. I'm really frustrated right now, because I feel like I'm deep in the middle of a he said, she said thing, okay? And I'm going to have to put my trust in my city council to study these issues and come up with your own conclusions. I know that's true. It's really annoying to think that I understand something and then have a person or multiple persons stand up and say, no, that's not true. This is not more volatile oil. This is not, you know, all of those things that we just heard. So I am against this project, and I had prepared, you know, some notes, but I don't want to waste people's time because the gentleman from the watch group certainly supported, you know, the things that I was going to mention. The particulate matter, the additional particulate matter in the air, people with asthma, all of that. COPD and lung cancers, these risks of potential damage from these trains are large. The costs and the risks are large. And the offset, we always want to offset risk with benefit, but the offset, it doesn't seem like there's any benefit. Doesn't seem like there's any, you know, anything to offset these costs to our people here in our county. And the other issue, I mean, you heard that Lisa, you know, she put a lot on the feds. We don't have any control over anything in this scenario except whether or not this spur is built. That's the only thing we can control. Whether the federal government does increase standards on the rail cars or acknowledge that the increased new and improved cars are actually not new and improved and are exploding, that's something we won't have any control over. I was on the train yesterday. For the first time in a long time, I took an Amtrak to Santa Barbara and back. And I asked one of the conductors, do you know anything about these oil trains? What do you think? Do you have an opinion? He said, no, I don't really have an opinion. I think he knew, but I'm not sure. You know, he was kind of evasive. But one thing he did say, I said, I know we share the tracks with Union Pacific. Is this going to make it more difficult to get on-time trains back and forth between San Diego and San Luis? He says, it's really going to affect it. You know, we got going to have 10 more trains a day. It's going to affect our operation. So that was about all he was willing to say. In closing, I urge the City Council to draft a letter to the Slow Planning Commission and the Slow Board of Supervisors stating our concerns as a community and opposing this proposed rail project. I think that's all we can really ask of our local City Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. And we'll have, if Kay Gore would come up next, and then that will be Martin Akel will follow Kay Gore.
City Council, I am a resident of Aurora Grande, and I'm not in the blast zone. However, as a citizen of Aurora Grande in San Luis Obispo County, I am really sick and tired of profits being more important than people. Obscene profits being more than people. And whether you realize it or not, nobody has stated that once that spur is built, then it falls under federal law. And any disinformation that has been given to us won't matter anymore, because federal law will then dictate. So if we do find that our air quality is worse, if we see cancer, lung cancer go up, if we see asthma go up, if trains start exploding down there, not in my blast zone, but in maybe some of your blast zones, then there's nothing we can do. So I agree with the last speaker. Number one, we need to have that spur not be built. But number two, I think all along the line, people are beginning to say, look, and I looked this up, and unfortunately I was down in San Diego, and I just got back, so I didn't get up on my computer, but I did start researching this. And in the last couple of years, there have been more oil train explosions than in the last 40 years. The tar sands up in Canada have recently been opened. It's just been the last few years. When this refinery was built, it was built for not tar sands from California, but California crude. And tar sands from California are going to go all over the world. It's not going to necessarily help us. If we want to lower the cost of gasoline in this country, then we probably should go to renewable energy, because globally the price of oil is dictated. In the 2014 summary of annual report of Phillips Conoco, they said, quote, if we get dirty crude, we'll get a savings of $1 per barrel across our refinery system, which will be worth $450 million net income to us. But what is the net income, as the last speaker said, for the rest of us? Is it worth putting property at risk? Is it worth lives that can't be replaced? Is it worth air quality? Is it worth all of these things? I see no uptake for us. I know you say, well, somebody down the line, then we'll get those trains. But no, not necessarily. I think we have to stop corporate greed. $450 million to them, how much to us? And we're putting all the other towns above us at risk. So I beg you to do what the last speaker said, to stand up and say, we don't want this spur. We don't want these bomb trains. And to look out for the citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Martin?
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. This is an issue that would reshape all of our lives, just reshape all of our lives throughout SLO County. I have the utmost respect for first responders, especially the first responder that's, who came up here, who was dressed in black. But there are many first responders who have differing opinions. 90 days ago, and I'm just responding to some of the speakers here, just 90 days ago, I sat at a meeting in SLO City, the city of SLO, and the fire chief of the city of SLO said, there are no certified hazmat teams in SLO County. Certified. Certified means they are trained to handle the huge explosive conflagrations that this thing would cause. So there are no certified hazmat teams here in SLO County. The nearest one is an hour and a half away in Santa Barbara. So that's fact one. And he also said we'd have to just wait for this to burn out. Number two, there was an issue here about some letter that was sent by Cal Fire to Phillips 66. I read that letter. I will supply you with that letter. That letter was written by Chief Lewin of Cal Fire in Nipomo, because I read it. I know it. And he warned Phillips 66 about the incredible changes that would have to be made based upon the type of crude being brought in and the danger of rail transport. He went bing, 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 bada boom, all the things that would have to be changed based upon what they intend. He was very intense about that. Next, Union Pacific Railroad stood up here and waxed about the technology and the positive train control and all sorts of things like that. Well, as they say in politics, just look at the record. There have been 40 crude oil hazmat, serious ones, not just one wheel going off the road, 40 serious crude oil and hazmat derailments in 24 months. Do the math. 40 in 24 months, serious ones. And they talk about the positive train control. Well, they can't control these accidents. These accidents happen based upon human error, mechanical failure, objects on the tracks. They can't control it. That's why, taking into account positive train control, the government has promised us there will be 10 major disasters per year for the next 20 years. They've promised us that, including that new technology. Lastly, I'm done with five. I have 3 seconds. I can't make
30.
It. You give me 30?
Oh, no, I was wrong. Sorry.
I have one question.
Go ahead.
The question is, based upon all of the cities and towns that have said they have all of their elected officials, and these are educated elected officials who said, do not let this happen throughout the coast of California. Are these people, all these educated people, so grossly mistaken? There are 4 counties, 11 cities, 4 unified school districts. Are they so grossly mistaken about what's in the EIR? Are they so ignorant that they oppose this? I think not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we will have Gary McKibble, and then followed by Tom Ryan. Thank you. Hi.
How are you? My question, really, I would like to be looking at Jim Anderson when I ask these questions, but I'm going to be looking at you folks for this, and it has to do with the issue of trust. I hope you look carefully at his slides that he had up there. He said one thing, which was picked up by Mr. Guthrie and corrected. He said the trains were 1 mile long. He's not right about the trains being 1 mile long. They're 1.4545 and, say, 1.5 miles long. If he's not right about that, how can we know that they're not going to put a little bit of diluent, the explosive stuff, to mix into into tar sands? He also had two slides up there that said, quotes, this was necessary to, quote, ensure the refinery's viability. He had another one that said, it was necessary to keep the refinery viable. Now, think about those words. That seems like code words, like, if we don't do this, we're going to go out of business and we're going to lose all our jobs and all that. We know that's not true by someone down in Houston at Phillips who's made contrary comments, which were on our slides. So though I'm looking at you, I'm saying to Jim, stop doing this. I am tired of hearing them saying words that make us think like, oh, my gosh, we're going to have to close up and everybody's going to lose their jobs. It's just so sad for us. No, I don't think so. And finally, since I have 1 minute left, and 1:30, I guess, here, I have another question, which is, We have given you how many reasons? 29 reasons on that slide, which we can give to you if you don't have a handout, why you should say no or we should say no to this project. I would ask Phillips 66 to give us three major benefits to the citizens, not to the corporation, not to Mr. Garland, Greg Garland, who made $24.5 million in compensation last year. Give me three benefits to the citizens of SLO County for allowing 520 crude oil trains to move through our neighborhoods each year. That's my question. Thanks.
Okay, Tom Ryan, followed by Kevin McCarthy.
Hello, Mayor Pro Tem Barnick, City Council members and staff members, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to speak briefly to the fact that the state of California has passed a bill wherein there'll be a 6.5 cent fee on oil companies for every barrel of crude that arrives in California on rail, and that money is to be used for funding of response activities. And it is, I guess, a proactive activity that the state has seen the problems of rail, oil train derailments in the state, and they want to be ready for more of those types of things. However, it appears that two major railroad companies, Union Pacific is one of them, have filed a suit in district court in Sacramento challenging the law that requires companies to come up with a prevention and response plan for these oil spills and pay the money. And I heard how Union Pacific is so pro-safety and on top of things, yet they seem to be opposing this new bill, which will allow for monies to be available for cleanup of spills. A question I have for them is, what is their responsibility for a cleanup? Let's just say a train derails, I don't know, right here in Arroyo Grande, and it causes maybe $3 billion of damage, if you want to include loss of lives, disabilities to family members, wherein they won't be able to support themselves through the rest of their careers or retirement, and that sort of thing, and the cost of cleanup. Are they going to fund every dollar of that? Are they going to repay the firemen and policemen for their time and overtime? And God forbid if one of them gets sick and the benefit costs for that individual, are they willing to pay for that? Because it seems that they're balking at just paying 6.5 cents per barrel. Yet they tell us that they care about the community and they are very safety-minded. So just in summing up the whole thing, it appears that in addition to the cost of cleanup, there is also a question about the railroad cars being used. It seems that the CEO of the American Petroleum Institute is lobbying to keep the CPC 1232 cars on the rails, even though they have been involved in the recent derailments. He said that because the refineries bought them in good faith, they should be able to continue to use them. I think of, would that be funny if Boeing would continue to fly their planes, even though it was a problem, and you and I would have to get in them anyway? But thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for that. And after Kevin will be Patty Welsh.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the council and staff. My name is Kevin McCarthy. My wife and I live here in the village. And I had an additional health concern regarding the Phillips 66 project that I wanted to bring to your attention. And I submitted a letter to Mr. Wilson, county planner, at the recirculated EIR phase of this. And in the interest of time, I'd just like to read that letter to you, if I may. Dear Mr. Wilson, I have reviewed the Phillips Refinery REIR information and feel that there is an important epidemiological issue that has not been addressed, namely valley fever or coccidioidomycosis. I have been a practicing physician assistant in San Luis Obispo County for 30 years and have seen a number of cases of cocci and am aware of an increase in cases over the last few years. I have confirmed this with the San Luis Obispo Public Health Department epidemiologist and herein have included numerous links to pertinent articles, including the San Luis Obispo Public Health Department dedicated cocci webpage. Coccidioidomycosis, or valley fever, is a fungus that is spread by way of spores that become airborne when soil is disrupted. Most cases of the disease are limited only to the lungs and cause pneumonia-like symptoms that eventually clear. However, the disease may disseminate and cause widespread organ involvement and possible death. There are certain higher risk groups depending on age, sex, and ethnicity. Specifically, I'm concerned about the volume of soil that stands to be disturbed during construction of the proposed rail spur at the Phillips 66 refinery. Referencing pages so-and-so in the REIR, I cannot find any specific quantification of yardage of dirt that stands to be disrupted during grading, construction, and berm building, but I imagine it would be substantial. Moreover, my understanding is that the predominant direction of wind flow during daytime hours is toward populated areas of the Mesa and Greater Napomo, which would tend to put those areas at potential risk of exposure to cocci. Additionally, the workers on site, both construction workers and permanent workers at the refinery, would be exposed depending on ambient conditions. I do not know if the fugitive dust emission mitigation plan is adequate to protect these individuals. The REIR states that with mitigation measures such as soil dampening, there would be, quote, 61% fugitive dust control, end quote. But I do not find any specific information suggesting that the threat of cocci infection was taken into account or addressed. Moreover, climatic conditions such as rainfall, especially after a period of drought, causes cocci spores to germinate, bringing up the question of whether dampening soil might actually aggravate a potential problem. Additional articles that I have included speak to the increase in cases of cocci associated with recent construction of the solar plant in California Valley, where there were 50, as well as an increase in cases involving workers at Camp Roberts during construction in 2010. So I would like to leave a copy of that with Ms. Norton, if I may, and I can give you a link.
Yes,
links on that as well tomorrow.
That would be good. Thank you, Kevin. Okay, Patty Welsh, that's the last speaker slip I have. So unless anyone else wants to fill one out, we'll end with Patty.
Patty Welsh, Arroyo Grande, and I'm going to switch the subject. I'm going to ask that the city enact a Stage 1 drought emergency so that we can seriously go after some of the high water users to either have them pay hefty water bills or cut back on their water use. This is the worst drought our state has faced, and I think we are behind in implementing action. I'm shocked by the number of people who live here who don't know about the cash for grass, the watering according to the numbers on your address, and they're still openly wasting water. What's going to happen if we have a major fire and they have to use Lopez water? Is it time to step up? It is time to step up and take this drought seriously. I don't know what we're going to do next year if we don't get rain. I don't feel all residents are conserving. I feel it is lopsided, and we need to get everyone conserving equally. One last thing, the sign that we have as you drive into the village, people have come up to me, and I know what you mean to say on it, but what they're seeing is no, no, no outdoor watering, conserve water on Wednesday. So they're thinking they're supposed to conserve water just on Wednesdays. And I know it's just a Freudian slip, but that's what I'm hearing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other speakers? Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Diana Robertson, and I live in Pismo Beach at the moment. We're putting our house up for sale. We've been here about a year from Oregon, and once we sell it, we'll be looking for somewhere else to a smaller home, either in this county or perhaps we'll go back to Oregon And so the oil train issue is really of concern to me. I mean, I can move away from Pismo Heights, which is a half mile from the blast zone coming through Price Canyon, but I think you all should know, if you don't already, that Judkins Middle School is a quarter mile from the track, so all your middle school kids are at risk. There probably are countless other landmarks, and I know the Butterfly Grove, as you know, is like right across from it. So the beaches, these things that really make this whole county just so beautiful and unique and precious, that can just, you know, go away. And people like us have a choice. We're retired. We could live anywhere we want. So are we really going to reinvest our precious dollars here in this county? Well, it really depends on what, you know, how you, the elected officials, stand up to this multinational corporation that just wants to make a few bucks at our expense. I've noticed my neighbors around here have a much higher cancer rate than we did in Oregon. Being new, I mean, I can see things with new eyes that the rest of you don't. I talk to some of people I meet, my neighbors, they don't know anything about this oil train issue. Maybe one in 10 does. So I'm trying to figure out the California personality, and I think it's that people are working so hard because it is so expensive here. They've just got their noses to the grindstone. When they have a little time off, sure, they go to the beach. But they really do trust you all to look at these issues and to, you know, they put you into office. They're working as hard as they can. The taxes here are very high compared to Oregon. So they really are putting all their trust in you to look after their best benefits and to protect this area for their children. And I hope you'll do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else like to speak on anything that's not on the agenda this evening? Go ahead, come forward.
I don't really want to speak, but I want to ask a question. What are the expected...
Get your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm Tom Sear.
Tom.
I live probably about 2 miles from the blast area. Anyway, my question has to do with something that's not about safety and all that kind of stuff. It has to do with land values. So what is the Phillips 66 project expected to do to the land values along the rail lines after the construction, after they're there? So we've got these homes in the trilogy on Napomo, along the Mesa, or where the Mesa School is also a little community of homes there. What's going to happen to those land values after that refinery is built? So it's just something to think about. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else like to speak on anything that is not on the agenda this evening? Okay. We will move on to the consent agenda. Okay, moving right on. The consent agenda. The following routine items listed below are scheduled for consideration as a group. Any member of the public who wishes to comment on any consent agenda item may do so at this time. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to come forward to comment on any of the consent agenda items? Okay, seeing no one, are there any council members that would like to pull anything from the consent agenda? Okay, then I will. I'm ready to entertain a motion.
I'll move approval of consent items 8A through 8D.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Kitty, may I have roll call, please?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Yes. Alrighty, and then we move on to public hearings. We have none. Old business, we have none. New business, item 11A, it's presentation by Southern California Gas Company, but that has been taken off our agenda and will be on a future agenda. Is that correct, Bob?
Yes, it's been continuing to a date uncertain.
Okay, thank you for
the motion.
Do Do we need a motion to continue that to a date certain?
Date uncertain.
Uncertain, sorry. No. Okay, thank you. Moving on, item 11B is a consideration of a donation of artifacts found at Howard Mankin's Huskow Park to the South County Historical Society and temporary street closure for LaPointe Street for the ribbon cutting ceremony. And Jeff is here to give us a report on that. Thanks, Jeff.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnage, members of the council, tonight I'm actually pleased to report on an item that we didn't know anything about 7-8 months ago. As you may be aware, or you are aware, we have been working on the Huskow Park renovation project for close to a year now, design and construction, and it's coming to conclusion. We're excited about it. If you haven't been by yet, it really looks sharp. We have a ribbon cutting scheduled for April 25th at 10 a.m., and we're going to that day recognize the folks that participated. One of the exciting things about that project was that it was truly a community-based project, and we had lots of folks help us on that project, including the Rotary Club, including Arroyo Grande and Bloom, and donations from our community. The Tree Guild participated, and also the South County Historical Society. And so during the construction of this project, staff was working with the contractor when the contractor notified us that they had discovered some old glass shards that looked to be like bottles, old bottles. That we stopped the project when that was discovered, and one of our staff kicked the dirt and found some intact bottles. We called out the archaeologist on the project, which is required in our process, and had the archaeologist do some inspection before we did any further work. And upon the investigation by the archaeologist, he found that there were some historical shards of glass and bottles and other artifacts that were found in one of the areas where construction was taking place. We notified the Historical Society about the find, and they were our partner on this project to begin with, and readily jumped in and conducted a dig on the site. And the artifacts that they discovered are on the table off to the west side of the room. We believe that was the archaeologist felt that it was probably a trash heap. It looked like some restaurant trash that somebody buried on the site back as early as 1910. We date some of the bottles and some of the other artifacts back to that date. The archaeologist considered the find to be historically important locally, however, not something that would prohibit construction from moving forward. We contacted the Historical Society and asked them to assist us in excavating the site, and they did so. In fact, tonight, Jan Scott with the Historical Society is here, and I'm going to ask her to come forward and talk a little bit about the dig and what was discovered. I do want to say that tonight we're asking for the council to do two things. One is authorize the donation of the artifacts to the Historical Society. We don't keep historical artifacts. We really don't have the capability and the resource to do so. And so we're asking that the council authorize us to gift these to the Historical Society. And also we're asking that you authorize the closure of LaPointe Street during the ribbon cutting so that we can conduct the activities from the street. I did have some photos of the site, and again, they're on the screen, on the table off to the left as well. And with that, I'll ask Jan to come up and do a presentation.
Hi, I'm Jan Scott. I'm curator at South County Historical Society, and I'm fighting the microphone. Jeff has basically told you everything. I just put out a call saying, would anybody be interested in doing a dig? And we got a crew of four people. Somebody from the neighborhood came and joined in. and they spent a very hot Saturday morning into afternoon digging and pushing dirt around. For us, probably the most exciting thing that was found is something we don't have in our collection, which is an Arroyo Grande Soda Company bottle. They're very hard to come by because when they're found, collectors grab them up. So that was exciting. We didn't have one. We borrowed one when we did our centennial exhibit. The state archaeologist who came to look at it after the dig was quite certain that it was a trash heap. And we said, how can you know that it's not an outhouse? And he said, no corn cobs. And that is how the scientists determine it. If there aren't any corn cobs, it wasn't an outhouse. He was pretty sure that all the bones were from one cow. So they were just butchering it as necessary and throwing the rest of it into the trash heap. The people who did it thought it was a wonderful time. They had a great time sorting, going through things, cleaning things up. And now we'd love to have them for the collection. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jan. We appreciate your help on the digging. Are there any questions of council members for staff? Okay. Would anyone from the public like to speak on this item? Okay. Then I'll bring it back to the council for comments. Barbara?
I think it's the project itself for the Juscal Park, how many people before this project really started knew that kind of odd-looking hunk of cement was really of historic significance? You could kind of check it out a little bit, but I think this just brings such a heightened awareness to that important part of the city's history, even though it does center around a jail. Please go out. If you can't join us on the 25th, please go out and look at that. If you are aware of what it looked like prior to all of the hard work by A.G. Bloom and the Five Cities Rotary, you know, it just looked like a cluster of weeds and things like that. Now it's very much defined. It even has a heightened area, so if you're sitting there on a picnic, you can really kind of look over the city. So tremendous job by everybody. It's so nice to get to see these community projects realized. So I just support it 100%, and then the extra bonus of the artifacts. I mean, how cool is that? So that's really all my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. Tim?
Thanks. I don't have anything further to add. I agree with Barbara completely. I would just say our family went through a similar experience with the artifacts. We had somebody knock on our door who had the old fire insurance maps and showed where the outhouses were, and he took a bar that was about 10 feet deep and dug around and found bottles. He was looking for a particular bottle. It's that pumpkin-shaped bottle that you'll see, but it had a Arroyo Grande saloon name on the front of it. It was worth about $3,000, and he was looking all over for those. He happened to dig in our yard during an earthquake, and he was down in the hole about 6 feet down when the earthquake hit. He got out of that hole faster than anybody I've seen. But just what a fantastic reminder of Arroyo Grande, just looking at that. And the Mankins family with Juscal Park, and all they've done to support it, and the other people that have quietly stepped up and made that a place to now go, where it was normally just a neighborhood little place to stop. It wasn't really a community-wide place that people would go to. It's just going to be a fantastic addition, so I'm very excited, and I appreciate Jeff's work organizing it and getting it moving forward. That's all part of the process. So, yeah, absolutely, I'm all for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Jim?
Yeah, I'll just quickly add to the thank yous to everybody involved in Juscal Park, and obviously this is what's great about having a historic society, is that really important objects like this can be preserved and displayed, and I'm absolutely for following through with this, including closing the street. Thank you.
Okay,
Thanks, Jim. I don't have much to add. I would just echo all the sentiments of the council members. This was a huge project for Roy, Granny, and Bloom. They were out there for days and weeks on end with the planning and the organizing, and I just really appreciate that they do so much for our city, as well as the Mankins family and staff. It was a real collaborative project, and that's what Roy, Granny is all about. So I'm happy to move forward with this, and I'm ready to entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move a resolution of the City of Arroyo Grande authorizing the donation of historical artifacts from Juscao Park to the South County Historical Society and authorizing temporary closure of LaPointe Street for a ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, can I have roll call, please, Kitty?
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Yes. Okay, moving on, item 11C, it's consideration of the governor's statewide mandatory water use restrictions and potential impacts on Arroyo Grande, and Jeff is going to present that as well tonight. Welcome again, Jeff, or Bob.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge, members of council, Jeff English, Public Works Director. Tonight, I am presenting an item, some information about the governor's recent mandatory statewide water restrictions that were issued. This is a historic execution of an executive order by the governor in that there has not been any mandatory statewide restrictions in the past. So this is unique. And it's evolving. This is something we're presenting tonight, the information that we know, and we don't know everything. And so we're in a process, and so I hope to go through and answer any questions that you might have and let you know what we've discovered about this recent executive order to date. Tonight, our recommendation is to just receive and comment on the report of the impacts of the executive order, which enacted mandatory statewide conservation requirements, and to approve additional water conservation measures to be implemented by city staff. I just want to go through a real quick timeline. Obviously, we've been in this drought for several years, going on 4 years now, and our council has been proactive with responding to the drought, and in fact, was one of the first agencies to respond to the drought back in 2011 when we implemented some ongoing mandatory restrictions. We have been looked to by other agencies for information throughout this process because we are so ahead of the curve in terms of some of the restrictions we've put in place already. Also, back in January 2014, the governor declared a statewide emergency. That had some requests that agencies do some restrictions and reductions on water use, but nothing mandatory. In 2014, the City Council approved our water supply and strategy and conservation measures, which we have implemented and been working on now since that action was taken by Council. In 2014, the Council adopted our emergency water use restriction methodology and implemented an ordinance to deal with potential water reductions in our supply. And then October 14th, 2014, the council approved the Lopez Low Reservoir Response Plan, which has been enacted and is in process now. And then finally, here in April, the governor's executive order. So this has obviously been an ongoing effort. The executive order timeline, which came out April 1st, was followed by, just a week ago, some draft regulatory framework requirements. And we didn't have them in time to publish them for the meeting, but I will ask those to be passed out to you. Those have some general regulatory frameworks, and I'm going to go over these in this presentation and let you know, the general parameters of the restrictions that are being proposed. There will be the draft regulations will be released on the 17th. So we haven't actually seen, and they have not been rolled out yet,
the laws and the regulations that will implement the governor's executive order. And so tonight what we will be reviewing is just some preliminary information. And then the emergency rulemaking, there'll be a formal notice that will be delivered by the state on April 28th, and they anticipate that the board hearing and adoption, and that's the water board. The governor has directed the implementation of this rule to be enacted by the water board, and the board will enact the rules and rule on those on May 6th. I want to talk a little bit about the framework, and I pass it out to you right now, and I'll just go over those in review. There are four major areas in the framework. One is the apportionment of water supplier reductions by tiers. There are four tiers. Not everybody can reduce water by 25%. Cambria has enacted some draconian restrictions on water use. There's not 25% more savings in Cambria. As a result, the state has recognized this, and that there are some users who need to and deserve to reduce more than 25%. And so that was taken into consideration in the regulations. So under 50, and this is all based on this RGPCD. It's the gallons per citizen per day. The state actually uses a different methodology than we do, so some of the numbers that you'll see are different than the numbers that we presented to you before, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But using the state methodology on determining the gallons per day per citizen, all those agencies that have under 55 gallons per day per citizen have to conserve 10%. That's going to be tough for some communities that are already conserving to the greatest extent that they can. And then 55 to 110 is Tier 2. That's a 20% reduction. Tier 3 is 110 to 165, and we fall in that group, which is a 25%. And then those agencies that are using over 165 gallons per citizen per day will be required to save 35%. At the bottom there, I indicated our current, based on the state standards, our current water use, which is 125 RGPCD. Our goal for 15-16 will be 114. I do want to state, and actually that's my next, one of the next slides is coming up. I'll follow up on that. There will be some new mandatory reporting requirements, which we are not doing now, but we do have this information, so it will be relatively easy for us to comply. Most agencies don't have to report on certain user groups now. In the future, they will have to do so, including large landscape and institutional customers such as the cemetery. The compliance assessment, group three, will be based on June 15th through February 16th of 2016. And that will be compared to the same period in 2013. And so that's our baseline. Our baseline is that period of time in 2013. And that's where the figure of the 125 was determined. Actually, it was, we're not sure their methodology on that. We believe it was just 1 month. They captured September. And use that month as the benchmark. We're trying to confirm that. The Water Board will assess suppliers' compliance both through monthly and cumulative water usage reduction. So not only will we have to achieve that cumulatively, but we will have to achieve it on a monthly basis as well. And again, we haven't seen the rules. We're not sure how that will be managed. It seems to us to be a little challenging and onerous. There may be a wet May coming up, and then the following year might be dry. So
if we get a lot of rain and people don't water, it's difficult to compare month to month over year, 1 year comparison, because the difference in atmospheric conditions. So we don't support that methodology. In fact, tonight, if throughout this process, if the council has any concerns that you would like us to convey onto the state, there will be a formal period where we can comment, and we do intend to make comments and hope to steer or change some of this legislation so it's workable. If you have those comments, we will pass those along as well. Enforcement, that's one of the differences in this legislation and the last one was, or the last governor's request for reduction, is that this has an enforcement mechanism, and it will be enforced by the Water Board. And so they have set out the framework for some of those enforcement mechanisms, and those are listed in the guide that I just handed out. The informal enforcement, such as warning letters. So we would imagine that there will be some kind of a tiered enforcement process where they would make some notification to agencies that aren't complying and then have some kind of ratcheted up enforcement process. And then there will be the option for the state to have formal enforcement actions, including cease and desist orders, which could potentially achieve a $10,000 per day for noncompliance. And again, not knowing the rules on how that would be implemented, we just want to inform the council of what is being distributed at this point. There will also be informal orders and something that they're calling a conservation order, which would go into effect immediately upon receipt. Most enforcement actions from the Water Board, you have a hearing and there's an opportunity for comment. There's a mechanism here where they're saying that they can enforce a conservation order, which would be required to be enacted immediately. And so we'll that's also listed in your packet, and we'll provide additional information as those rules are developed. There's some additional prohibitions and end-user requirements that will be the owners of the water user to comply with, not the agency. And that will be any new construction of homes and buildings. You will only be able to irrigate those by drip or micro-spray systems, which are the MP rotators, and we've talked about those in the past. It's a different type of spray nozzle. So the typical overhead irrigation would not be allowed. We're anticipating that we'll have to change our landscaping ordinance or some ordinance to comply with this for new construction activities. And then the use of potable water to irrigate ornamental turf on public street medians will be prohibited. We do not have any street medians that have grass. Many communities have medians that have turf on them. I did get a question today regarding a couple medians we have on one street in town, Diana Place. It's a grassy area. We don't interpret that as a median. We interpret that as a landscaped area in a cul-de-sac. It's not a center street median traditional. We're looking at again, we don't have the definition from the state, so at this point we don't anticipate that would be under this jurisdiction. Just want to talk a little bit about our trends. Since 2000, and this is using the methodology that we use, which is we believe that the state's methodology on determining the resident gallons per day is based on a percentage of residents. We do a different methodology, which is common for the area. We have in 2000, 192 gallons per citizen per day, and that's gone down steadily. 2013 was 164. 2014 was 144 this last year. We are trending down. In fact, our programs are really starting to kick in. We're seeing some results of past conservation measures, and the folks who are reducing their turf now, removing their turf now, and using other conservation programs, we're starting to see the benefits of that. This was in the paper just Sunday. Everybody's going to need to help out. We're asking our community to improve their efforts to conserve water and to participate in our programs. What we're requesting of the council tonight is to authorize city staff to allow staff to implement the following programs. One is to reduce the city irrigation on our landscape areas by 50% now. We believe that that's going to cause some of our areas to brown, and we will keep our turf alive, but we will have some brown turf, and that's a recommendation from staff tonight. Increase the turf mowing height from 2 inches to 3 inches. This does have an effect on folks who play soccer and play baseball. The ball doesn't roll as fast. It stops it. So it's a management practice that actually helps us save water. Conduct in-person contacts with the city's top 100 water users. We plan to visit all of our top 100 water users in person, knock on the door, and ask them to participate in our programs. And outreach, we're going to work with all the commercial, the top commercial users, the top landscape users, and the top residential users as well. Did want to comment, I think I mentioned this last time, that one of our top water user in the past was the Rio Grande Cemetery. They participated in an irrigation retrofit program a year ago. We just recently calculated their water use. They've saved 49% of their water year over year, and so pretty excited about that. And they called us to see what more they can do. And so they're no longer our top user. They're down the list of ways. Place the city's portable message board out. We know water days, and we recognize that we need to change the order of the message. Thank you for that comment. Not the first time that's been mentioned, but there's a technician who works in the police department who programs it, and we will work with them tomorrow to change that. We did step up enforcement on water wasters. Staff will bring in, if council authorizes, some of our public works crews on an early shift to go around before sunrise and look for folks who are that's typically the time that people irrigate. Oftentimes the irrigation is set so that it waters their driveway or it waters the street. And you see that often where there's water running down the gutter. And so it's our intent to do some early morning drive-throughs and let those folks know. In many cases, the residents just don't know because by the time they get up, it's dried up or they see some results of it, but they just don't know. And so we want to communicate with those folks on a personal basis. And then engage all city staff to observe and report water use violations. We will be meeting soon with the code enforcement crews. We have a No Water Wednesday policy, and all of our staff need to know that. And to this point, it has only been the public works staff who's been enforcing those. We want to educate and enlist all of the city staff to participate in this process. Mail reminder notices to all of our water customers about the mandatory restrictions, and we have a draft, if you would be willing to hand that out this evening. This is a notice that we've prepared to send out in the mailer, the next water bill. So it will go out the 1st of May and the 1st of June. This is the piece that will go out. And it will talk about our rebate programs, our free programs. It will steer folks to our website and provide them with lots of resources. It also, on the back, it has information about our mandatory water restrictions. So there are watering schedules. It has the watering schedules on the back. Odd and even addresses can water Mondays and Thursdays. Even numbered can water on Mondays and Thursdays. Odd numbers on Tuesdays and Fridays. There's no irrigation allowed on Wednesdays. Also, on ongoing requirements, there are a number of ongoing requirements that are in our mandatory ongoing water restrictions. Outdoor irrigation is not allowed between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Use of water, which results in excess gutter runoff, is prohibited, and that's what we talked about, and some folks just don't know that their irrigation is doing that. No water shall be used for cleaning driveways, patios, parking lots, sidewalks, streets, except where necessary to protect public health and safety. Emptying and refilling of swimming pools and spas is prohibited. Outdoor water use for washing vehicles, boats, buildings, other similar uses shall be attended and have a hand-controlled watering device, typical including a spring-loaded shutoff nozzle. And then finally, use of potable water for construction activities such as dust control is prohibited.
Jeff, can I just interrupt you real quickly because I don't want to forget. I pay my bill online, my water bill. Is there any way to attach this or send it along with the email? I don't know how many people from the city pay their bills online, what the percentage is, but, you know, this has a lot of good information. It's you know, I think people will read it. It's short and succinct. Can we do that, or is that?
I don't know if we have that technology. I'm assuming we can. I will investigate that. Okay. It will be available on our website. We will have it at our city facilities, and yes, if we have the capability to do that, we will.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that. Sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt.
And then finally, begin recognizing a monthly water conservation champion. We mentioned the cemetery, and we're proposing to have them as our first champion. We have some homeowners who have had significant dramatic reductions in their water use. We don't have criteria for this. We want to recognize folks who have participated in our programs, so show some benefit from participating in the Cash for Grass program or others, and then recognize them at the podium. And that would begin at the next meeting if council approves. And then finally, to continue with our water conservation strategy previously approved by council. Again, we believe that that is working. We're seeing benefits. The comparison year over year, I wanted to tell you that we have already achieved a 16% saving for our state target. So we only have to achieve an additional 9% to meet the state requirement. And based on our trajectory and the savings that we're realizing, we believe that we can do that through our increased conservation programs and through the measures that we're recommending tonight. With that, I'll open up for any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Barbara, do you have any questions?
So you just said that we have 9% more to meet the 25. Did I understand that correctly?
Correct.
Or the reduction. So then when you were speaking earlier about the 125 RGPCDs.
Correct.
With a goal of 114, where is that just doing the math there for the 114? You mentioned 114.
We calculated that today. Okay. It's based on the 25%, we did the math and came up with 114. It's not a state. They did not distribute that information. We'll wait and see whether or not they follow up, but we want to know what the criteria will be. We calculate it will be about 114.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Can you just explain a little bit about how someone can be anointed the water conservation champion related to use of water bills? I think, does Shane already have some information just based on reduction? Is it that simple? Just so if people really wanted to step it up and get that acknowledgement,
competition.
That competition, it's always healthy, I think.
We have not proposed any formal criteria for water conservation champions. If that's absolutely we can, if it's based on a percentage reduction, our plan was to recognize folks who have had a significant reduction and have participated in our program. So there are some criteria. And generally, it's they would have to have some time where we could actually go back and evaluate.
Sure.
So it would need to have 1 year of use after their conservation measures were put in place, so we could compare previous use to current use. So
okay. Thank you for that. I mean, I certainly am not suggesting some complicated, you know, criteria and committee members and all of that. I just thought it would be helpful for folks to know kind of what the parameters were and the ranges were. So thank you for that. And then the last question I have, it really pertains to schools. Given that our schools are some of our largest water consumers, I know we've been very focused on what the city can do and what residents of the city can do regarding their water reductions. But what measures will be taken to incorporate school campuses? I know we have one pool facility as well as the sports fields for water conservation program. What kind of dialogue are we going to have with them?
We have ongoing dialogue. We have participated with Paulding already and with Ocean View on water conservation projects where we went in and at city expense did a renovation project for their irrigation and turf. And so we have – it has not been a year yet, so we don't have those statistics, but it's getting close.
Okay.
So we have been working with them closely. They have an interest in keeping their bills low as well. We do plan to meet with them in the coming weeks and talk about additional steps that they can take. We are coming forward with a 50% reduction in irrigation for our turf. They have some different demands in that they have sports activities going on, competitive sports activities, and other concerns that we don't necessarily have. However, we will be engaging them in one-on-one conversations here soon.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all I have.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. Tim?
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. First off, did Soto Field get retrofitted? I've forgotten.
Soto has not.
Okay. So I want to go to page 3 of your regulatory handout under small water suppliers. I'm making the assumption that small water suppliers means people like on the Mesa or the smaller water purveyors is what we're talking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. We are not a small water supplier. The 3,000 connections is the distinguishment between a larger and a smaller supplier. The small suppliers, Templeton, there's a number of small, Golden State Water up on the Napomo Mesa, there's some others that fall under these rules. We do not.
Okay, so my question is, under that section, in the first paragraph, it talks about achieving a 20% reduction, and then it says farther down in this next paragraph about apportioning, it seems to read 25%. Am I misreading that?
To be honest, I didn't even look at the small water supplier data because it didn't affect us. I was looking at that's the apport. They'll probably have some apportionment mechanisms for small water suppliers, those that can prove that they've done some conservation measures already.
It just seems like, based on the reporting requirements mentioned here, that smaller water purveyors have less of a regulatory framework than larger ones. They're allowed to do less, it seems like.
They don't have some of the reporting requirements that the larger agencies do, and this is all evolving for the state as well. And so they don't have some of the mechanisms and the data in place to regulate some of the small water purveyors. I would imagine that will be part of the rulemaking, is that they will have to do some kind of reporting.
Okay.
I don't know enough about it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Okay, Jim?
Yeah, I just have on changing the watering on the turf. I'm thinking Soto, anywhere where we have sports taking place, what's the impact when you – I understand the 3 inches, but what's the impact to the turf areas when we cut back water by 50%? You know, and I'm thinking specific of Elm Stream Park, where I've seen the really pretty significant deterioration out there in the center of that park where they played a lot of soccer not that long ago. And that area is pretty rough already. And I'm just wondering what's your long run? If we did this for a year, are we going to have any turf left?
It will present a challenge. Some areas will we may lose some turf. We do an annual turf renovation project already. You may have noticed that typically December through the end of December, January, February, March, we actually close the fields with the exception of the park. The sports fields, we actually close them down. We reseed them. We fertilize them and renovate the turf. So it gives them an opportunity to recover. We actually one of the few agencies that does that regularly on an annual basis just to maintain good quality turf. So this may result in some areas that that will require more renovation and don't recover as quickly. So it's to be seen. I'm going to leave that up to our landscape professionals to make some determinations on how much water. When we say 50%, it may be more in some areas, maybe less in others, and that will be managed by our park staff in a manner to maintain the turf's viability. We don't want to lose that's a huge investment. We don't want to lose our turf. So our goal is 50%. It may be achieved at some of the outlying areas so that we can save our sports turf. It's going to be an evolving process.
I also had the question there was the mention of the Water Quality Control Board and the working on a million acre or million square feet of turf and replacement. I know that the regulations are still coming out, but are we looking at trying to participate in that?
Absolutely. We have our eyes set on that one. We're hoping it's retroactive because we've taken out a lot of turf and we have the documentation to prove it. I don't know what the rules will be, but absolutely, that's one we are tracking closely.
And then I noticed the other day when I was walking early in the morning that we have the non-potable water there at Soto Sports Complex. I know we use it, but it appears that there's also contractors using it as well. Do we track how that's used once because it looks like they're filling their own vehicles? Their own trucks. Do we track what happens with that water after they fill it? I assume we're getting paid for it somehow, but
we do. There's a meter, and in order for them to use that water, it's tracked, and we bill them for that water, and so it's charged. Actually, they have to come and get a permit at City Hall, and they have to sign up. They have to leave a deposit. And then they will use the station. It's monitored by our staff. We watch it. We lock it up at night, open it up in the morning. The water is for use here in Rio Grande only. And so it's something that we don't have tracking mechanisms on all their trucks, but it is intended for a Rio Grande. And we keep a close eye on that. We watch who's coming up to it. We know where their projects are. If we see a contractor, Shane's really good at this. If we see a contractor and our water staff, if they are not working on a project in town, we stop them and we will enforce our rules. So we know where the construction projects are and who should be using that water. And it's close by our office. So
we shouldn't be concerned about somebody reselling non-potable water for irrigation somewhere.
That is a concern. It has happened in other communities, and we heard a report that it happened here in town. We followed up on it. Can't confirm it, but we try to police that as best we can.
Okay. And then the last question I also had was small water. I understand that you didn't look at it. Do we have any concern about, I know that there are certainly ag wells that we're not concerned with, but I know there are a couple of other small wells in town. I think the high school has one. I know that we supply water to a couple of places. Do we have any kind of responsibility as far as policing those possible wells that are within that are non-ag that are within our community? Are they small water users?
They are typically they're not considered small water suppliers. If you have a well on your property and use it on your property, you're not supplying it to anybody else, and so you are not regulated by us. Or there's some reporting requirements to the county, and that information is between the property owner and the county. However, they're not considered small water suppliers as regulated. That's one of the, you may have seen some criticism in the news, one of the challenges on the governor's restrictions is that municipal supply is 25% or so of the state water use. And so we're being asked to save 25% of 25%. So it really, in the big picture, doesn't do a whole lot statewide. The ag community statewide is not regulated under that message, and there has been some criticism in the press about that.
I wasn't directing it at ag, but just specifically whether we had responsibility. Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple of follow-up questions, Jeff. Who do the citizens contact, or what's the best way for them to contact the city to report water wasters? Because I know that you get phone calls and emails and people walk into City Hall. So what's your preferred method of people that are out walking and see the abuse happening? What would you like them to do?
All the above, but our preferred mechanism is on the city website. There is a request tracker icon where on the city's website you can actually report a water issue, and it goes directly to our utility staff to deal with. That's the best way we can respond to you. Email is fine. Phone call to our office, 473-5485. Drop into City Hall. Any way folks can report. We do prefer that mechanism, the request tracker on the city website.
And where is that on the start page? Is that on the home page of the city website, or do you have to go to the water department tab?
It's on the home page. Okay. I can't get to the internet here.
Well, that's okay.
On the city's homepage. You can report. You don't have to navigate anywhere. It's right there.
It's right there. Okay. And then on item number 7 on the governor's executive order, let's find that. Oh, that's in the staff report. I think you had a slide on it too, Jeff, talking about the turf. And so if you go to... right there, I think. The use of potable water to irrigate The use of potable water outside of newly constructed homes and buildings that is not delivered by drip or micro spray. I know what drip is, but micro spray, I think I know what that is. Is that something that if you go to put in a new lawn today, that's what you're probably going to install? Or not? Is that?
So this is not being mandated. Again, this is an end user requirement, and so we're not sure how the state's going to enforce this. Generally speaking, those irrigation on new homes are through our landscape ordinance, and we could regulate that. Again, not seeing the rules, we don't know how the state will enforce this. However, it is being placed on the end user. So the water board could have some mechanism to come out and deal with homeowners themselves. I don't know.
Okay. Go ahead, Bob.
On the micro sprays and micro drips, the difference between those and the typical atmospheric sprinklers that you use in the yard is the micro sprays are described in gallons per hour, as opposed to the regular turf that are described in gallons per minute. So a typical turf sprinkler, had a small one that you use in your yard, would be from 1 to 4 gallons per minute. A micro spray is 1 to 3 gallons per hour. They're normally not used in turf situations.
Oh, they're not.
They're very restricted in the landscape. The turf is a very difficult one to irrigate under any circumstance, whatever type of water. The major irrigation companies have all come out with low spray, low precipitation rate heads. It's a whole emerging industry, but it's one that I just was actually meeting with a major irrigation supplier who is dealing with this as a conversion because the turf simply, however you put the water on it, from an agronomic perspective, requires a certain amount of inches of water per year, regardless of how you put it on. There's more effective ways to apply it, but it still requires a certain number of inches a year to be able to grow. But these that are being referenced are a whole different type of spray, really for non-turf applications. They're extremely effective.
Okay, so probably homeowners that today go out and put in a lawn, they're probably not the landscape company wouldn't normally go to the micro spray option, is what you're saying.
There is a new head. There are a whole new series of heads out that are a very low precipitation rate head. They apply the water at a rate that allows it to sink in, to precipitate in faster before it would have the chance to run off. It's just a reduction in the gallons per minute, and it's applied in a way that allows it to precipitate at a more uniform rate.
Okay. Okay, those are my only questions. So unless we have any follow-up ones, I'll open it up to the public. Anyone who would like to come forward and speak on this item?
Since this is my favorite topic, I do have some great suggestions. I'm never going to win the program for cutting water because I've been doing it for so many years. But I talked to Jim about this. Loomis tank. I'd like to see if maybe the city could talk to them and get us AG resident, a little bit of a discount on their tanks, and even a 55-gallon. And the reason I say that is I'm getting ready to take the pipes in my kitchen and my bathroom and disconnect the P-trap and put a 5-gallon bucket under there so I catch every drop of water that comes out of my faucets. And, you know, I need something to put that water in, and I'd like it a little bit sturdier than a 55-gallon trash can. Also, one of the things the city can do, I've done it at my house. I've gone under my sink, got to the cold water supply, and turned it almost off. So you're getting a drip of water. You open that faucet all the way, you're not going to get a rush of water. I feel I'm saving water that way. Simple to do. I flush my toilets now with gray water. I save 1.6 gallons. Doesn't seem like a lot, but I'm saving water. After school program, Jeff, you might like this. If they could do like a pizza party or something to get the kids' ideas on how they could save water, and then the children who implement it at home, they get a video or something. I'd be willing. You get a kid to do that, I'll buy the video for them. Also, citywide contest, Barbara, this might be up your alley, for the most innovative idea or something along that way, get the citizens involved. You know, we're all in this boat together, and we might be amazed at what people come up with, and give them like 10% discount one time on a water bill. You'll be amazed at how many people will jump at that. And I think those are my suggestions. Thank you. And, Jeff, by the way, I love the presentation. I see where the city has saved a lot of water, and thanks.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else like to come forward and comment?
Hello, Kevin McCarthy. I commend you on the 50% reduction. My only concern is maybe all of this on the part of the governor is not enough. Headlines a month or so ago said that California has 1 year left of water. And I don't know what we have locally in our aquifers, our wells, Lopez Lake, but as I say, I'm just concerned that it may not be enough. And one thing I might think about is warnings on these flyers that go out to the public that the next step is maybe rationing and having a low threshold for initiating that if there isn't adequate compliance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments from the audience? I'm sorry, could you, I didn't hear your name. Could I get that for the record?
Yeah, Patsy Sheehan.
Okay, thank you.
It's just a problem. I've always, like, used either drip or, you know, soakers or something like that, you know, since I've lived here. But I've noticed in the last few years I haven't been able to do that because the critters are eating through the, you know, hoses trying to get at the water because of the drought. And does anybody have, like, a suggestion for that?
I've never heard of it. Do you have any suggestions? I've never heard of that. I have lots of drip at my house, and I don't think anyone's eaten through it.
That's a very funny, yeah. Only yeah. Anecdotally, it's exactly what was happening. I have a slope, and that was happening on my slope.
Yeah,
and
I
it was so frustrating because I converted everything up. It's kind of why I know the volumes on the microscopies right now. I bought hundreds of them, and I had to actually put up a little animal watering basin way up my slope, and that actually dealt with it. It's a very small area, but they chew through the pipe to get whatever water was in the pipe.
Yeah, it would just be to give them an alternative. Sometimes you can bury the drips. You know, there's other methods. I did want to also say that on our Think H2O website, there's lots of tips, water savings suggestions, and we also have a Facebook page where people can interact. And so some of the comments that I heard tonight, we will look at ways to put some additional comments on our website.
Okay, good. Thank you, Jeff. And if you have a Facebook page, if you share or ask people to like it, then it just sort of takes off and more people can have access to that information. Okay, so bringing it back to the council. And Jim, comments?
Well, certainly I do think it's a great presentation, but there's still a lot of unknowns. I do think we have made great progress. I think as pointed out, though, there are a lot of I actually don't see how Cambria can find another 10% when you're down to 44 gallons a person per day. I don't see how they can. I'm going to say we're probably in the sweet spot. I hate almost to say that, but probably in the sweet spot as far as the amount that we need to save and the room that we have to do it. So, yeah, I'm certainly in favor of all of the things that have been mentioned tonight as that we should do immediately, and we'll deal with the state's regulations when they come down. You were asking for comments to pass on to the state. I do think that the one-size-fits-all is going to be problematic, and I recognize how difficult it is for the state to have to deal with many, many different communities and what they're doing. But I do think that would be the one comment I would be passing on to them. It's going to be very difficult to try to do a one-size-fits-all. Cambria is just one example I can think of. Beyond that, I'm in favor of everything you're proposing tonight. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Barbara?
Thank you. I think it's a great idea for the use of Facebook and expanding that, you know, kind of getting a dialogue with people as far as, well, this is what worked for me, or just like the suggestion about providing an alternative source of water for critters. I mean, how many people would really think to do that? So that would be another way to enhance that dialogue just with citizens on, you know, our areas. Some people have really sandy soil. Some people have, you know, different soil mixtures where watering, you know, doesn't evaporate as much. So there's all kinds of just idiosyncratic types of things that, you know, folks in one neighborhood might be able to solve versus other people living in a different area. Also, I would really like, related to comments to the state, would be to, you know, want clarification on how the RGPCD, great, another new acronym, you know, how are they derived, really, to assure the accuracy? I know there's another jurisdiction that's already going to be questioning those. So I think you're already on it, Jeff, as usual, right on top of things. And then also what the water board variables are for calculating, you know, they wanted this to be tracked on a monthly basis. How many more jurisdictions do it on a yearly basis right now? And, you know, what accuracies can they guarantee us and also support whatever it would be that would be most efficient for our city and most efficient for our staff, mainly for the accuracies and consistency there. I certainly support all of the things that you're bringing forward for conservation measures. I am very glad that you're having a dialogue with the schools. Nothing against the schools here. It's just something that hasn't been really discussed in all of the hard work that our staff have been doing. So I'm really ready to move forward. Just tremendous work on behalf of the staff and public work staff. Just amazing, and thank you for that.
Okay, thank you. Tim?
Thanks. First of all, great presentation, as always. Appreciate it. Hot-button topic. I'm totally for your water conservation immediate measures that you want to adopt. I don't see a specific resolution, but I'm definitely for that. I just want to point out, though, in your alternatives, on number 3, you have direct staff to draft a resolution enacting Stage 1 emergency water restrictions. I've been kind of beating the drum on this for a while, and Shane came and kind of said, well, you know, we're okay for now. And then we have this edict from on high that says we have to approve or get another 9% out of our system, like Jim said, might be difficult to do. I still believe that council should consider rapidly moving into Stage 1 water emergency, and I'd like to put it on the agenda for a specific discussion on that, because I don't see any benefit to waiting. If we're trying to conserve and get another 9%, why aren't we in a Stage 1 emergency situation? It seems like the state is trying to prod everybody to dig deep, and that would seem one of the things we should do. So. And then lastly, I am very concerned about small water purveyors given the Santa Maria water adjudication, and I'd like to have some discussion with the state about stronger regulatory framework for smaller water suppliers, because they have in effect affected our local area, and I think that can't be ignored. So. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tim. And let's see, my comments. I like everything that's being proposed. I especially like the electronic board. I think that having it right as people come into the village or wherever we're going to put it, where a high traffic area is, I think that everybody's going to read it and pay attention to it. I honestly think, as I've said before, people don't read the paper. They don't know necessarily we're in a drought. It rained, I guess, a couple of days ago. I wasn't here. I was back east. And so I think people just are under the assumption that, oh, you know, we're good. It rained. So I like the electronic board. I like the idea of the water conservation champion. I think that's a great idea. The staff coming in early to make note of the water wasting. I also think that's a great idea. I feel bad they have to come in when it's still dark, but it's all right, I guess. And on that note, you know, I was out at Strother Park when I did my police ride-along, and there's a lot of overspray out there on the site, and I just remembered it when you were talking about staff coming in early. It might have been fixed by now. That was a couple weeks ago. And then just a comment on the... you know, it's in the governor's executive order where he, you know, they mention the grass. And I really think that going forward that we should have a prohibition on any new turf being installed with any new construction. I'm appalled that people are installing turf. It makes me sick. It makes me sick when I see brand new houses and this huge, I feel like I'm in a dream, because we are in such a dire situation here, and it's not the way it was 10 years ago, and it might never be that way again. And we can go back to allowing turf in the future, but just to irrigate this big lawn is just I just I can't wrap my head around it, and I think that with all new construction, we have to say absolutely no turf at all. So that would be I would like to include that, or if we have to bring it back because it's a new idea, you know, we can get the other comments from the council members. But I just think that's a really good idea because of the state we're in. And I think those are my only comments. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, just jump in. For just two of the things I did. I did want to get back and see if we could review the possibility of doing the rain barrels. I don't know quite how you would do the calculation on how much water they save, but if we could see, I'm actually thinking of some sort of a rebate program. I'm not sure it's fair to ask Loomis to discount them, but it'd be great if they would. But I do think that. And the other suggestion that I'd written down that I'd forgotten about was it's great to have the water champion, but I think it might be interesting to do on the website to list the top 100 somehow. Again, I don't want to create some sort of accounting nightmare, but, you know, there's those people that made it, but then there's probably a whole group of people who are close. And it might be interesting just to have the top 100, and ultimately we might have to have the bottom 100. But just a couple of thoughts.
The top 100 water wasters or water savers?
Water savers.
Positive enforcement.
Go the other way around, yeah.
Right.
So ultimately, we have to go the other way around.
We'll put the wasters on milk cartons.
Okay. Any other comments?
I do have one other comment, and this is more of a statewide issue. It has to do with, everybody, at least in our area, it seems like our city, we've been very focused since 2010 on water conservation. You know, we get it. But I think the people that don't get it are the people at the state level. I think that this 25% reduction is kind of like the horses that have been out of the barn for 3 years. And last year there was a 20% reduction, wasn't enforced, didn't give anybody any parameters. Now they're upping it to 25%. Yet there is still a release of fresh water to the tune of over 400,000 acre feet going into our oceans. Based on environmental, oh yes, there are, and still continues to be. And so I think that a stronger voice to our state is to reconcile in some way the balance between environmental issues and saving certain species of fish, and moving the balance and the pendulum a little bit more toward saving of our ability to grow food for our people, and to not discontinue the conservation efforts. But I don't hear anybody really, except maybe McClintock, talking about really having a serious discussion. There's a city up in the northern part of the state that is being required by the federal government to release enough water that this week that would serve the cities of Stockton and Santa Barbara because of concerns related to six species of fish. So we also have the federal government competing with what the state is trying to do. So if the state is proactive, then they still have to go through the federal government to get the national fisheries to understand just what a condition that we have. So thank you for allowing me to soapbox a little bit. But there was one gal in the audience that wasn't aware of this happening, and it's been ongoing for several years now. And some people say that our drought could also be man-made related to those kinds of policies. So thank you for that time. Look it up. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. So where do we stand on my idea about having no new lawn installed on new construction?
That item is not on the agenda tonight, and we would need to bring that item back. Probably packaged with a few items that were discussed tonight. The rain barrel program, we have discussed some potential gray water changes. So I would recommend that we bring those back in the form of a package of additional conservation measures.
Okay, sounds good.
I think what you're going to experience as our drought team continues to meet and ideas come up, we want to just regularly and frequently be coming back to City Council with ideas. There actually has been some discussion. We were actually just talking about the use of artificial turf, what the zoning code allows in front yard, backyard. There are certain restrictions and also allowances. There's a lot on the turf side that we need to be doing more. We've been having some discussions. So great idea. Appreciate actually opening the door for that.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Excuse me. And also we did hear to put on the agenda for discussion the stage one. So we'll bring that back for discussion, not to consider stage one, but whether or not to have the discussion on if it would be agendized.
I do want to interject that our stage one restrictions are based on our supply and not being able to meet our demand, and that's not currently an issue. We do have a projection to meet our demand this year and next year, and if you want to bring that item back, we may want to look at changes to the ordinance so that we could implement stage one. And the city attorney has a comment on that. I don't know that just meeting the governor's quota is dealt with in our ordinance.
Yeah, we've actually, the attorney, Mr. Hirsch, has been working on this, has been doing a good job in educating us about that there are parameters that have to be met before we can actually go to stage one, before we can make some of the recommendations that are contained within the water code. He is the expert on those, and so our report that we've come back with, we need to have him really do a good job of explaining what those parameters are.
Sure, go ahead.
Given your discussion just now about that issue, and I totally get where you're coming from, is there some other mechanism other than our current stages that can say, based on some sort of water emergency, we need to do X, Y, and Z that wasn't contemplated when we did the ordinance?
Well, we actually asked the council, the action that the council took in April, modifying the measures that council had originally anticipated last year. We actually have begun to have some discussion about, is there something in between where we are right now and the full stage one, and are there other actions in there? And there, so that perhaps might be the door to, it's not really exactly a stage one, it's a stage half. That we might be able to do that would have different types of restriction requirements or current water availability requirements that would give us an allowance to take some next action.
Thank you.
Okay, and I just have one final question, Jeff. I know that I think that you had mentioned or maybe the consultants had mentioned before when we were talking about this that in the San Luis Obispo County, Arroyo Grande citizens had the higher gallons per day use. We were the highest water users, but then I saw the article in the Tribune and it didn't list us. I think it was alphabetical, and so at first I thought it was, but we weren't the highest users of the gallon of water.
That's not the case. We are not the highest in the county. I do have a list of all of the statewide users, and I'll hand that out. It's kind of interesting. The lowest per capita in the state is Cambria.
Yeah.
They use less water per capita than any agency in the state.
What is that?
They are at 41. 40. It's interesting on this list. The highest user is... they've got some users who are 400 and 500 gallons per resident per day. So it really is startling. Those are agencies with, large public areas, lots of turf, Rancho Santa Fe down in the Palm Springs areas. So, striking the difference between some agencies. Cambria is on the first page there. Grover Beach is at 52, has had significant reductions. On page 5, San Luis Obispo at 114.
On page 6 is Rio Grande at 125.7. And Santa Maria there at the bottom on 6 at 131. And then the highest, well, Atascadero, Paso, and Napomo are on page 8. In 140s, 150s. And then the highest in the county is Pismo Beach, which is 175. They are challenging. We're all a little fuzzy on how these were calculated. And some agencies are challenged. For instance, Pismo Beach has a lot of hotels. And that water use is calculated against them. And so they have some limitations on how they can enforce water use on hotel customers. And so, you know, there are some problems in the methodology. But anyway, to answer your question, we are not the highest user in the county. We're middle of the road.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. And if anyone has any more follow-up questions, go ahead, Barbara.
One question. Based on what you know or what we don't know and what the state doesn't know regarding what Governor Brown would like us to implement, we are going to be implementing a program on contacting the highest water users. So in that little conversation you're going to have with the governor related to what our concerns are, hopefully the state program or the water board will be looking at the gallons used just like we just did related to some of these other jurisdictions related to their just absolutely, I'll just say, obscene use of water considering the conditions. So a little more work for you, but I think that would be important. So thank you. And now I'm really done.
It's all good. Okay, we are to item number 12, which is council communications.
Do we need to move forward?
Sorry. Oh, my gosh. Look how I'm just moving right along.
I'm ready to go home. I'm liking it.
Okay, we need to receive the report. So we need a motion for that.
No, we need to adopt the additional measures on page 3.
Oh, sorry.
I didn't see that.
Okay, hang on.
The last part of the recommendation.
Okay.
You could say move to approve staff's recommendation and probably get there.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. Can I have roll call, please, Kitty?
Councilmember Brown.
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnett.
Yes. Okay, now we're on number 12, council communications. Anyone from the council have anything to say?
I do.
Okay, Barbara.
I just wanted to make sure the public was aware that there is a special meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District Board of Directors. It's been scheduled for Thursday, April 16th at 6 p.m. It's at the Board of Supervisors Chambers located at 1055 Monterey Street in San Luis Obispo. It will be a closed session on the following item. It's a conference with District Council pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 concerning pending litigation regarding Friends of the Ocean Anno Dunes versus San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District. There will be public comment on this closed session item. So anybody wishing to comment, hopefully we'll see you April 16th. And then also a reminder that there will be a budget workshop at the upcoming meeting of the Five Cities Fire Authority Board being held on Friday, April 17th. That's at 10 a.m. It's at the Grover Beach Council Chambers on 8th Street. And I'm encouraging the public to attend, or please contact me and share your thoughts about the authority's upcoming budget. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Are you sure, Barb?
Yes, thank you.
I do. Just quickly, I just want to reiterate that I am very interested in, I understand that the mechanism might not be right, but the goal of a water or a stage one water emergency is something I think we need to really look at. I understand the way the ordinance is written that we probably can't specifically call it that, but the goal should be the same if we're trying to save an additional 9%. Whether we can actually do that or not, I suppose if Grover's at 52 gallons, I suppose we can. But anyway, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jim?
Yeah, I will say I attended the last Board of Supervisors meeting because they were considering the animal shelter replacement. And I do think something we should definitely have, maybe even consider asking them to come down and do a presentation on it. It could be as much as $50,000 to $60,000 additional expense to us, which gets it up in the $120,000, $130,000 range. And I just felt sitting through the presentation that they really hadn't done a full analysis of replacing the old building versus the new one and exactly what they were going to get for their money. So that was going to be my suggestion, and I'm not sure they would take us up on it. We would ask them to come here and give us a presentation on the analysis of what they get. I don't think there's any question that something needs to be done. I'm not questioning that. What I'm questioning is how much do you get by fixing the old building versus the other. They think they had it out at $5 million additional $5 million to replace it, and I just didn't feel that was very well fleshed out there. And I think we might ask them to come here and flesh it out for us so that we can understand how they're arriving at the need for a new building. And I'm thinking of our police building. We went through a lot of analysis before we finally, I'll say settled for, and we end up with most of what we want. And the question is have they done that analysis so that they actually have an informed decision about what they could get for $3.5 million? Are they getting 80% of what they want, or are they getting 50%? So I'd like to see us at least request that they come and make a presentation on that.
Okay, I would definitely support that. I think there was, I can't remember reading from someone the reason they gave before a new building was something to do with the foundations, or
there was foundation issues. There was the effects, just like any old building when you go to replace it, that the bids were coming in high because they didn't know what they were going to find. But I think what's driving this, from sitting through the presentation, there was a report done by SPCA, I guess, whatever the U.S. version of that is, and they wrote a report. And based on that report obviously that's going to be the Cadillac version of that would be my expectation, that's Cadillac version, and that it would, for them to satisfy everything in that report, that they would need this new building. Now, maybe they would only get, 50% of that report, and that might be unacceptable, but I just didn't get the sense that was made clear. It's like, if you want to get all the way to here, it's $10 million, and if you want to get to here, it's $4 million. And I just like to hear the analysis, because we're going to be the ones who have to pick up. We're going to pick up 8% of that tab, if I'm remembering right. But I think the cities overall are picking up 70% of the tab. So it's easy to be a hero when somebody else is paying. So I think we'd ask them to come here and do a presentation for us.
Okay. Thank you for that. And then I would like the issue of the rail spur to come back, as far as us writing a letter to the Board of Supervisors. I know Steve Martin, I read the article in the paper, I think it was today, that the city of Paso Robles, obviously they're a lot closer to the rail throughout their city. I know Paso didn't necessarily write a letter that said yay or nay on the issue. Because of the recirculated EIR, it was basically, here are our concerns. Can they be mitigated? Can they not? And so I think that other cities are weighing in as well. And with Paso Robles, I didn't have time to find the letter. I just read the article, but I'd like to see the information from that letter and maybe write a letter that's similar, just expressing some concerns with that project.
Question about that. There was a mention about the recirculated EIR. What's the time frame on that? When the information would be out and about?
I'm very sorry. I actually know what it is, but I'll find out.
I did ask him that, and he said they're planning on being in front of the Planning Commission, in sometime during the summer. I think that's sort of my 10 cents worth on it, is that we have a lot of conflicting information, which I think. Maybe most of it will be fleshed out when the EIR is resubmitted, but I think we sort of have the luxury here of this will almost certainly be appealed, and I would actually think we would want to take a look at it after the full review by the County Planning Commission, and I mean clearly we have concerns here, but we also have a lot of conflicting information that I think will be sorted out
but much better when the county does their full process.
You mean appealed from the Planning Commission?
Yes. Yeah, almost certainly be appealed from the Planning Commission. And I would say if it's not appealed from the Planning Commission, then you know, what was sort of what was the point of if it ends up being that simple, I'm not sure that we need to have a position on it. I will point out that at least the Paso Robles position that was reported.
Tim, am I past it?
Way beyond the line.
Am I? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
On both
are
items.
Are we way off? Way off? We're way beyond.
Well, no, the discussion should probably stay pretty minimal for this item if it's going to come back.
I guess I should look that way.
we'll bring the report back for council consideration. You can have all the deliberation at that point.
Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate.
Do we need to agree to do that?
If you want to put it on an agenda formally, take a vote now. That's how it's set up.
I would prefer to wait until we have much more information, and you know, postpone it being put on the agenda until after the EIR. So I wouldn't be supporting it at this time.
Is that true with the pound as well? Did you want to wait, or did you want that on a new?
Well, if that's the will of the council, I'm fine waiting. I just I don't know how much I can talk about it, so I'm just going to look straight at Tim. hesitate. I mean, I'm okay with that. I just think that I don't want to wait until it's too late. I want to make sure that, you know, there. For me, there are concerns. Maybe with you know, no one else, it's not as clear to them. But I guess I'm happy to wait for that. It's not the will of the council. So I guess we'll just table that until the summer, until that goes before the Planning Commission. Okay.
We'll put it, as Tim just noted to me, we'll put it on the master calendar on both of those. But the animal control, as Tim had noted, is there a consensus to bring the animal control back?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay, staff communications, anything?
No communications.
Okay, final opportunity for community comments and suggestions from anyone in the audience. Okay, seeing none, item 15 is closed session, so we will adjourn to closed session at this time.